Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Come here, Susie. You remember me? Your daddy's friend, Henry?
No, don't!
When a South Charlotte principal looked into what appeared to be an Instagram squabble between adolescents, she turned up something much creepier. WFAE education reporter Ann Doss Helms explores a middle school detective story that carries a warning for parents.
It was shortly before Thanksgiving when Community House Middle School principal Jamie Brooks got a message from the mother of one of her students. The student had received a threat from an Instagram follower after telling that follower he planned to block him.
And so I got that in the morning and figured I was going to be dealing with a situation of a student in my building threatening another student via social media.
The first thing Brooks did was look at the name on the social media account where the threat came from, AlexSanders999. She didn't have a student by that name, so she called the boy who had received the message into her office. He said he didn't know Alex Sanders, but had given that person access to his private Instagram account because they had friends in common. Brooks asked the student to show her the Instagram account on his phone.
So I opened it up, and I could see the picture, which looked like, quite honestly, a 10-year-old kid.
Brooks couldn't see much about the account, but she saw the names of three other people Alex Sanders was following, two students at Community House and one at nearby J.M. Robinson Middle School. Neither of the Community House students knew Alex Sanders either. But one had followed him back, which meant that when he gave Brooks his phone, she could see a bit more about AlexSanders999.
The person had no posts, no pictures posted whatsoever, and was following about 175 people, and I noticed that they were all boys.
Alex Sanders had launched a private message thread with that student. It started out chatty.
But then Alex Sanders asked my student to send him a picture. He said, send me a face pic.
That's where the student stopped the conversation. Nothing had happened, but Brooks was suspicious. She alerted the police officer assigned to her school and got in touch with the parents of the kids who had connected with Alex Sanders. The next morning, one of those mothers was in her office. She had brought her son's phone.
And now Alex Sanders had about 380 kids he was following. So overnight, he went from about 170 to 380, and they were still all boys.
There was a chat that was starting to look familiar.
Starts off with the, hey, what are you doing? How old are you? What sports do you like? Send me a picture. Felt very much to me like somebody was trying to bait kids, kind of step by step.
To understand what happens next, it helps to know a bit about Brooks. In 2013, she learned that some of her male students had been circulating a photo of a female classmate with her breasts bared. She investigated, and while a photo hadn't been taken at school, Brooks was dismayed by what she uncovered. For instance, there was an app that looked just like a calculator on the screen, but was actually used to hide photos and videos from prying parents. That set Brooks on a quest to keep up with harmful technology and to educate parents about all the ways their kids can get into trouble online. Brooks admits she finds cyber sleuthing kind of fun.
You know, my favorite TV programs are CSI and all of those things, and I swear in my next life I'm going to be FBI.
But her crusade is serious.
I feel like we've got to help one another because these kids are way ahead of us with the technology. And if we're not willing to get out there and try to get in front of it and help each other, then it's going to win. It's going to beat us.
So Brooks could have stopped with alerting the school police officer and a handful of parents to the Alex Sanders 999 situation. Instead, she went through the list, all 380 screen names, and wrote down all the students she recognized. There were about 10 from Community House. She called them in one by one. One student had sent Alex Sanders a face shot, and then, after some badgering, a photo of his abs.
And then Alex Sanders went a step further and asked him what kind of underwear he wears, and then ultimately asked him to send him a picture of him in his underwear.
By now, Brooks felt certain this was not a student trying to make friends. She forwarded all the information she had to police and sent a warning to Community House families. It urged them to remind their children not to interact with anyone they don't know in real life. She also contacted Instagram about what she believed to be an online predator. Tuesday afternoon, she checked to see if Alex Sanders 999 had been shut down.
And the account is still there. It's still private, and there are 373 people that he's following.
Brooks, who has two teenage sons of her own, knows as well as anyone that middle schoolers want their privacy. Yes, she says, they'll balk if parents insist on snooping. Do it anyway, she says.
You just have to have a relationship with your child where you say, hey, let's sit down with your phone tonight, and I want to scroll through your Instagram. I want to go through your Snapchat. I want you to open up your My Eyes Only account within your Snapchat.
In case you're wondering, My Eyes Only is what Brooks describes as a password-protected secret vault for photos and video, sort of the latest version of the fake calculator. And that, she says, is why parents can't back down.
I think it's extremely difficult, but I don't think it's impossible, because the bottom line is, who's paying the cell phone bill?
As for Alex Sanders 999, I sent that account a message Tuesday identifying myself as a reporter and asking for comment on Brooks's concerns. I got no response and was promptly blocked. For WFAE News, I'm Ann Doss Helms in Charlotte.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation. What is everybody in Europe worried about now?
She's been Germany's leader for 14 years, and today, for the first time, Angela Merkel has been visiting Auschwitz. The Chancellor was taking part in a ceremony at the site of the Nazi death camp in which more than a million Jews were murdered.
To remember the crimes, to name the perpetrators, and to maintain a dignified memory of the victims is a never-ending responsibility. It is not negotiable, and it is an inseparable part of our country. To be conscious of this responsibility is a firm part of our national identity.
The Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki and a survivor of the camp were also attending the ceremony. Our Berlin correspondent Jenny Hill was listening to what Mrs. Merkel had to say.
Two things stood out for me from the speech that she gave. The first is that she didn't shy away from laying the responsibility for the horrors perpetrated at Auschwitz and elsewhere, of course, at Germany's door. She said she'd struggled to find the right words, but she said she felt deep shame in the face of the crimes committed, she said, by Germans, crimes which went beyond the borders of what's imaginable. Interestingly, because it has been a sensitive issue in Poland, Auschwitz is often described as a Polish death camp. She's specifically said, you know, it's very important that we remember that this was a German concentration camp run by Germans. And the second interesting thing, though, bear in mind that Angela Merkel is visiting not just nearly 75 years after the liberation of the camp, but at a time when anti-Semitism, nationalism, forms of intolerance do appear to be very much on the rise here in Germany and in other parts of Europe. And she made that very clear in her speech, saying that what happened here can happen again. Our values are very precious, they're very vulnerable. Now, you'd have heard Angela Merkel saying this kind of thing before. She's very keen to champion the so-called liberal values upon which Europe, modern Europe, is built. But I think she went a little bit further today, because she was saying, you know, we do have to protect them, and that's not just about rhetoric, because actually these days we are starting to experience a concerning increase in racism, intolerance, and she mentioned anti-Semitism, which she said is threatening Jewish life in Germany.
She's been the leader for 14 years, and this was her first visit. That has raised some eyebrows.
Well, I think you need to look at the sort of the protocol, if you like. These kind of visits are usually reserved for heads of state, so the German president would often make this kind of visit. Angela Merkel has visited other concentration camps in Germany in particular. She's actually only the third German chancellor, I think, to visit Auschwitz, both Helmut Schmidt and Helmut Kohl before her. So it's not something which raises eyebrows here in Germany, although I can see that it might elsewhere. The timing is, of course, important. Angela Merkel is generally considered, well, she's in her final term. There are question marks over whether she'll complete the term, although she says she will. She'll be in the job till 2021. But I think she is looking to her legacy. There's no doubt about that. Bear in mind, of course, the far-right party AfD got into the German parliament on her watch. It's a source of bitter regret for the Chancellor, I think. So she's keen to make sure that she upholds those values of which she is so fond.
Our Berlin correspondent, Jenny Hill.
What is everybody in Europe worried about now? Why genetic annihilation?
For decades, racist incidents have consistently cropped up in stadiums across Europe at soccer matches, or football as the rest of the world calls it. Racist chants and insults seem to be increasing, especially abuse against black players in European soccer. The head of the European Soccer Association is now owning up to this and his own organization's insufficient response. Here's the world's Roopa Shenoy.
There are so many examples I could tell you about, but I'll stick to just last month. Two Ukrainian teams were facing off in Ukraine. Referees had already chastised fans for racist jeers twice when they did it again. One of their targets was Afro-Brazilian midfielder Tezan on the Shakhtar Donetsk team. He gave the fans the finger and kicked the ball into their section of the stands. Tezan got a red card and was banned from his next game. He later tweeted that he felt helpless but had to do something. In tears, Tezan walked off the field, which also earned him criticism.
I don't think players should walk off the pitch because I think that's what the racists want you to do.
That's Trevor Sinclair, who played for Blackpool in the 1980s and also faced racist taunts.
In them days, you were told to just man up and get on with it, and we did that to prove them wrong rather than go in a negative way. Go and speak to the governing body and make sure they're aware of it and make sure they follow up with your complaint.
But that approach hasn't seemed to work so far. Critics say soccer's governing bodies have been way too lenient. Critics, who include British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. He spoke out after England's Euro 2020 qualifying game in Bulgaria in October. Bulgarian home fans made monkey sounds at England's players and performed Nazi salutes.
The referee has clearly brought things to a halt here. We had fears of incidences of racist abuse.
Referees stopped play twice, but didn't take the ultimate step they're allowed to in response to racist behavior, to cancel the match entirely and refer it to the disciplinary committee of the Union of European Football Associations. The BBC asked the head of the Union of European Football Associations, Alexander Seferin, if those penalties are really working to discourage fans from saying racist things.
They are, but not enough.
In a step toward doing more, Seferin says he'll add black members to the disciplinary committee, which is all white and all male.
I don't think that anybody's doing enough of racism. We're trying to do as much as we can. I don't say we cannot improve, and we are trying to improve, but it's a problem that is more than just football.
Seferin's pointed the finger back at Boris Johnson and other politicians who've made racist comments. He said they encourage the racists who hurled abuse in stadiums.
Football is always the reflection of society. And in Europe, I would say things are worse and worse every year.
That's a sentiment that's echoed by scholars like Marko Antonsic, a senior lecturer in human geography at Loughborough University in England. He says people who consider themselves traditional Europeans are reacting to rapid demographic change around them caused by migration.
So the old society was somehow not prepared to face this transformation.
And Antonsic, who's Italian, says far-right populists like Italy's Matteo Salvini capitalize on that. Salvini's leader of the Anti-Immigration League and, until earlier this year, was Interior Minister and Deputy Prime Minister. His slogan was Italians first.
And if it's okay that these people say Italians first, well, then we have a problem with people that might not look like an Italian, which still today should be white and ideally also Catholic.
even if they're born and raised in Italy. Antoncic says Italians don't see children of foreigners as Italian, even if they're on one of the country's most popular soccer teams, like Mario Balotelli is. He was born in Italy to Ghanaian immigrants and plays for Brescia. Last month at a game in Rome, people in the stands made monkey sounds at him. Balotelli kicked a ball in their direction and began to storm off the field, but was held back by other players who convinced him to stay.
Just simply because of the color of the face can't belong here. So unless we break down this logic, there is very little chance that in the future we'll see different behavior in the stadiums and outside the stadiums.
Teams and commentators have been adamant in their support for players who've faced racist taunts. But for now, players are left to decide for themselves what to do in the moment when they're targeted. Some have already made the decision, like midfielder Georginio Wijnaldum of Liverpool and the Netherlands national team. He told CNN that he feels he must leave the field when these incidents happen.
I think everyone should do it. That's the way you support another person.
If players simply keep playing, Wijnaldum says fans who shout racist taunts will never stop. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
No, you won't be naming no buildings after me. They go down the lactate. No, you won't be naming no buildings after me. My name will be stated surely.
Rosa Parks is the woman who refused to give up her seat on the bus. It was 1955, it was the segregated South, and it was the start of the Montgomery bus boycott. From that moment on, Rosa Parks became an icon in the civil rights movement. But for a long time, we haven't known much about her as a regular person.
Is that Rosa Parks on a yoga mat?
A few days ago, I went to see a new exhibit at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. It's called Rosa Parks in Her Own Words, and it shows a very different Rosa Parks than the woman we learned about in history class.
She was a radical. She maintained a calm demeanor, but beneath the surface was always that militant spirit, and that buoyed her and that guided her throughout her life.
Adrienne Cannon curated this exhibit, and she says that militant spirit was instilled in Rosa Parks when she was a very small girl.
The right of self-defense was stressed in the home. You can see in that early sketch, early childhood incidents and experiences, she opens it with talking about the Ku Klux Klan riding through the community, terrorizing black families, burning churches and homes in the aftermath of World War One, and that she sits up at night, fully dressed with her grandfather, keeping visual over the home. They often sat up all night long because they couldn't take the chance of being caught off guard. And she says that she wanted to see him kill a Ku Kluxer.
She says that?
She says
that.
As a child. The first one that entered our house would surely die. This when I was 6 or 7.
I talked to Carla Hayden, the current Librarian of Congress, to learn more about the exhibit.
This exhibition, Rosa Parks in Her Own Words, gives you the impression, that title gives you the impression that there's a story that's been told about Rosa Parks, but it's not quite the whole story.
People have a view of Rosa Parks as this very sedate woman with a purse, and that's the iconic image, and she was just tired. And what this exhibit does is show you that there was so much more to Rosa Parks in terms of her belief in civil rights, her determination, and also the hardships that she endured because of that.
Do you think she was concerned that she had become a one-dimensional figure? Because she must have seen herself described as a demure seamstress and thought, what the heck? That's not me.
And I think that when you look at the photographs in the exhibit, you look at her writings, you also can imagine that every now and then she probably had a very small smile when she thought about that. You get to know Rosa Parks as a person and not as an icon. And she is so relatable in that way. You feel like you're visiting one of your grandmothers or your aunt, and you want to hear more from her, and you just start speaking in a different way when you get into the exhibit as well.
Who was she as a little girl?
She was feisty.
Feisty.
And the anecdote of her being just a little bit, not violent, but she thought about it.
And it becomes clear as you walk through the exhibit that her family were feisty people. These were not folks who sit by and let things happen to them.
And when you think about what was going on in the 50s, I was alive then. And in fact, I talked to my 80-year-old mother recently, and she remembered in 1955, we were in Tallahassee, Florida, and things were pretty rough at that time. And so to have a young person with these this determination to fight for rights and to be part of a movement was brave, took a lot of courage.
There was the risk of physical harm. She
yes.
would have known that.
Yes. And at that point, you get a sense that she was making a decision, a conscious decision, that she was going to do what she could to help others, and she was going to take the risk.
Which is a lot gutsier, frankly, than just refusing to get up, than just saying I'm tired.
And that's what we hope that people will get from the exhibit, and that they will realize that she was embraced by a Stokely Carmichael and younger activists and Angela Davis's mom. And she
Lights of the Black Power Movement.
She participated.
She wrote a lot. The exhibition is called Rosa Parks in Her Own Words. And I thought that was metaphorical. But in fact, she wrote a lot. She wrote letters.
Wrote a lot.
She kept what looked like diary entries. What in there surprised you? Did you read anything that surprised you?
Well, the strength that comes through, but also the forcefulness in her writing
that
comes through, and the repetition. And it's almost a stream of consciousness aspect. And so she's demure, she's ladylike, but in her writing, you can see that there were these deep feelings and emotions that she was expressing.
And yet hardly a picture where she's not smiling. And I found that impressive. She seems to have a cheerful heart. I had not seen, you know, I had seen the pictures of her around the time of the boycott. She would have been in her early 40s. We see pictures of her younger and older and then much older. And she has a serenity about her, doesn't she?
And she seems to enjoy being very well presented. And there's a beautiful video and a photograph of her in a gorgeous gown, floor length, kind of sequined and lace, and it's pink, her favorite color, and she is just happy as a lark. She just looks wonderful at the Essence Award, and she's just beautiful. And you can see that that was something that made her happy.
Your colleague, Adrian Cannon, the curator, described Rosa Parks in our interview as both a militant and a radical. Lots of people, when they're young, can be described that way. Was Rosa Parks that way in her 80s as she aged?
She certainly was, and you can see her, as I mentioned, with Stokely Carmichael and in other instances where she's with people who are doing groundbreaking things, presidential candidates, Jesse Jackson. So she was active politically, and she was right up to the minute. She was at the Million Man March and participated in that. So Rosa Parks kept her hand in the game a little bit.
That was Noel King speaking with Carla Hayden, the 14th Librarian of Congress, and Adrian Cannon, the curator of the library's exhibit, Rosa Parks in Her Own Words. It opens today.
Check out, girlfriend. Ooh, I don't believe it. Will you just look at her? Trying to paint some life into that face of hers. You think she realized by now it's the hair? It's all about the hair.
New research is raising concerns about the safety of permanent hair dye and chemical hair straighteners, especially among African-American women. NPR's Patty Naiman reports on the study published online in the International Journal of Cancer.
Previous research with animals has found links between chemicals in hair dye and straighteners and cancer. Researchers wanted to know whether women who regularly dyed or straightened their hair were also at greater cancer risk. They analyzed data from a large ongoing study of more than 46,000 women between the ages of 35 and 74.
55% of women in our study reported using permanent hair dye in the last year.
Researcher Alexandra White with the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences studies environmental risk factors for breast cancer. After 8 years, she found a much stronger increase in breast cancer risk among Black women compared to white women.
In white women, we saw that permanent hair dye use was associated with about a 9% higher risk, whereas in Black women, that risk was about 45%.
The risk increased even more among Black women who dyed their hair frequently, every 1 or 2 months. Researchers don't know what exactly might be the cause. The study did not look at the ingredients and the products women were using, only whether they had used the product and whether they developed breast cancer. As for chemical straighteners, risk didn't vary by race. Both Black and white women who used hair straighteners were about 30% more likely to develop breast cancer than those who didn't.
For the chemical straighteners, one of the big concerns there is formaldehyde, which is a known carcinogen.
Dr. Otis Brawley is a medical oncologist with Johns Hopkins University.
We've got numerous studies to show us in the laboratory that these hair dyes, and especially hair straighteners, cause cancer in laboratory animals. And this study is one of several now that suggests that they also cause cancer in human beings.
The elevations in breast cancer risk may sound high, but Brawley says they don't compare to known risk factors like obesity and lack of exercise. To know for sure what risk hair dyes and straighteners pose, Brawley says long-term clinical trials with a control group and placebo are needed, which would be difficult, if not impossible, to do.
Sometimes science just cannot give us the answers that we want it to give us.
For both races, there was no increased risk for women who used semi-permanent or temporary dyes, the kind that eventually wash out with shampooing. To reduce risk, researcher White says women might want to choose these products instead. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
You know, first ladies usually have a cause, and you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt, and we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
To grasp the phenomenal scale of YouTube, consider that people spend 1 billion hours watching videos on it every day. It's the most used social network in the U.S. More queries are typed into the website search bar than anywhere online except Google, which owns YouTube. But the site has come under increasing scrutiny, accused of propagating white supremacy, peddling conspiracies, and profiting from it all. They recently agreed to pay a record $170 million to settle allegations that they targeted children with ads. YouTube is being forced to concentrate on cleansing the site. We visited the company's headquarters in San Bruno, California, to meet Susan Wojcicki, the 51-year-old CEO in charge of nurturing the site's creativity, taming the hate, and handling the chaos.
We have 500 hours of video uploaded every single minute to YouTube.
Say that again?
So we have 500 hours of video uploaded every minute to YouTube.
That is breathtaking.
It is. It is. We have a lot of video.
And a lot of influence on our lives and how we pass our time.
Riding on a horse.
Over 1 billion people listen to music on YouTube every month. It's the planet's top music site. There's a children's channel with over 44 billion views.
Do you let your children watch YouTube, including the young ones?
So I allow my younger kids to use YouTube Kids, but I limit the amount of time that they're on it. I think too much of anything is not a good thing. But there's a lot you can learn on YouTube. I think about how YouTube in many ways is this global library. You want to see any historical speech? You could see it. You want to be able to learn a language.
Make a souffle.
Different. You want to laugh. You just want to see something funny. You want to do a souffle. Oh, yeah, cooking. Cooking's a great example.
Who's watching people binge eat?
With the subject Ukraine.
A growing number of American adults are turning to it for their news, sports, medical information. It's now mankind's largest how-to collection.
Take the thick end.
How to tie a tie. Tie the knot. Or speak tie.
As in?
The site has produced whole new pastimes where millions watch strangers open boxes.
Hold your phone like that.
Whisper. Sleep. YouTube's artificial intelligence algorithms keep recommending new videos so users watch more and more and more.
Find your solution at ShopView.
YouTube makes most of its money from ads.
Hello, let's do this.
Splitting revenue with people who create all kinds of videos.
Instead of acrylic paint, you're going to be using enamel paint.
From do-it-yourself lessons.
Then it goes ta-ta-ta.
To hip-hop lessons.
Clicking here.
The more popular ones can become multi-million dollar entrepreneurs.
Joe Biden promised Ukraine $1 billion if they fired the prosecutor investigating his son's company.
YouTube also makes money from political ads, a thorny issue because some of them have been used to spread lies on social media.
Facebook is facing a lot of controversy because it refuses to take down a President Trump ad about Biden, which is not true. Would you run that ad?
So that is an ad that right now would not be a violation of our policies.
Is it on YouTube right now?
It has been on YouTube.
Can a politician lie on YouTube?
For every single video, I think it's really important to look at it. Politicians are always accusing their opponents of lying. That said, it's not okay to have technically manipulated content that would be misleading. For example, there was a video uploaded of Nancy Pelosi. It was slowed down just enough that it was unclear whether or not she was in her full capacity because she was speaking in a slower voice.
Why would I work with you if you're investigating me?
The title of the video actually said drunk, had that in the title. And we removed that video.
How fast did you remove it?
Very fast.
But not completely. We just did a search, and there it was, still available. The company keeps trying to erase the purported name of the impeachment whistleblower, but that, too, is still there, which raises doubts about their system's ability to cleanse the site. In the 2016 election cycle, YouTube failed to detect Russian trolls who posted over 1,100 videos, almost all meant to influence African Americans, like this video.
And please don't vote for Hillary Clinton. She's not our candidate. She's a old racist bitch.
YouTube is an open platform, meaning anyone can upload a video. And so the site has been used to spread disinformation, vile conspiracies, and hate. This past March, a white supremacist live-streamed his killing of dozens of Muslims in Christchurch, New Zealand. He used Facebook, but for the next 24 hours, copies of that footage were uploaded on YouTube tens of thousands of times.
This event was unique because it was really a made-for-internet type of crisis. Every second, there was a new upload. And so our teams around the world were working on this to remove this content. We had just never seen such a huge volume.
I can only imagine when you became CEO of YouTube that you thought, oh, this is going to be so fun. It's people are uploading wonderful things like
funny cat videos.
And look at what we're talking about here. Are you worried that these dark things are beginning to define YouTube?
I think it's incredibly important that we have a responsibility framework. And that has been my number one priority. We're removing content that violates our policies. We removed, just in the last quarter, 9 million videos.
You recently tightened your policy on hate speech.
Mm-hmm.
Why'd you wait so long?
Well, you know, we have had hate policies since the very beginning of YouTube.
But pretty ineffective.
What we really had to do was we had to tighten our enforcement of that to make sure that we were catching everything. And we use a combination of people and machines. So Google as a whole has about 10,000 people that are focused on controversial content.
I'm told that it is very stressful to be looking at these questionable videos all the time, and that there's actually counselors to make sure that there aren't mental problems for the people who are doing this work. Is that true?
It's a very important area for us. We try to do everything we can to make sure that this is a good work environment. Our reviewers work 5 hours of the 8 hours reviewing videos. They have the opportunity to take a break whenever they want.
I also heard that these monitors, reviewers, sometimes they're beginning to buy the conspiracy theories.
I've definitely heard about that. And we work really hard with all of our reviewers to make sure that, you know, we're providing the right services for them.
Susan Wojcicki showed us two examples of how hard it is to determine what's too hateful or violent to stay on the site.
So this is a really hard video to watch.
Really hard.
And as you can see, these are prisoners in Syria. So you could look at it and say, well, should this be removed because it shows violence, it's graphic, but it's actually uploaded by a group that is trying to expose the violence.
So she left it up. Then she showed us this World War II video.
I mean, it's totally historical footage that you would see on the History Channel.
But she took it down.
Why?
There is this word down here that you'll see, 1418.
1418 is code used by white supremacists to identify one another.
For every area, we work with experts, and we know all the hand signals, the messaging, the flags, the songs. And so there's quite a lot of context that goes into every single video to be able to understand what are they really trying to say with this video.
Looking at behavior and context.
Seeing how we're being used.
The struggle for Wojcicki is policing the site while keeping YouTube an open platform.
You can go too far, and that can become censorship. And so we have been working really hard to figure out what's the right way to balance responsibility with freedom of speech.
But the private sector is not legally beholden to the First Amendment.
You're not operating under some freedom of speech mandate. You get to pick.
We do, but we think there's a lot of benefit from being able to hear from groups and underrepresented groups that otherwise we never would have heard from.
With name calling of Nazi or propagandist.
But that means hearing from people with odious messages about gays.
Mr. Lispy Queer from Vox.
Women.
Sex robot.
And immigrants.
I think the easiest way for Mexicans to not get shot and killed in Walmart is...
Wojcicki explained that videos are allowed as long as they don't cause harm. But her definition of harm can seem narrow.
So if you're saying don't hire somebody because of their race, that's discrimination. And so that would be an example of something that would be a violation against our policies.
But if you just said white people are superior by itself, that's okay.
And nothing else, yes.
But that is harmful in that it gives white extremists a platform to indoctrinate.
We want a flourishing, healthy white race.
And what about medical quackery on the site, like turmeric can reverse cancer? Bleach cures autism. Vaccines cause autism. Once you watch one of these, YouTube's algorithms might recommend you watch similar content. But no matter how harmful or untruthful, YouTube can't be held liable for any content due to a legal protection called Section 230.
The law under 230 does not hold you responsible for user-generated content. But in that you recommend things, sometimes 1,000 times, sometimes 5,000 times, shouldn't you be held responsible for that material? Because you recommend it.
Well, our systems wouldn't work without recommending. And so
I'm not saying don't recommend. I'm just saying be responsible for when you recommend so many times.
If we were held liable for every single piece of content that we recommended, we would have to review it. That would mean there'd be a much smaller set of information that people would be finding much, much smaller.
She told us that earlier this year, YouTube started reprogramming its algorithms in the U.S. to recommend questionable videos much less and point users who search for that kind of material to authoritative sources like news clips. With these changes, Wojcicki says they have cut down the amount of time Americans watch controversial content by 70%.
Would you be able to say to the public, we are confident we can police our site?
YouTube is always going to be different than something like traditional media, where every single piece of content is produced and reviewed. We have an open platform, but I know I can make it better, and that's why I'm here.
Black babies cost less.
Family members of missing black girls are pleading with the media and local law enforcement throughout the country to please finally do something to raise awareness about and investigate their missing family members. Now, when it comes to the number of people missing in this country, black people are actually disproportionately overrepresented. So they make up about 12% of the overall population, but over 30% of missing individuals. And oftentimes, law enforcement won't investigate it. And there's some more evidence. This is actually from the FBI National Crime Information Center. And again, you can see 14% of US children are black, but black kids account for more than a third of missing child cases. And so, these stories, I mean, it's true. These stories don't get reported the same way or as often as they do when the missing child is white. And so I want to give you a great piece that ABC News did earlier this year about missing black girls and why it is that local law enforcement doesn't do much to investigate it. Take a look.
It's very hard living day to day, not knowing where your child is.
Paula Hill hopes that someone who sees these photos will help bring her missing daughter home and help mend her broken heart.
She's 8 on here. I brought her on the back.
10 long years have passed since the young black girl in these precious memories disappeared without a trace. Her name is Shamika Cozy. She vanished just a few days after Christmas that year.
On December the 28th, 2008. That was the last day that I seen her.
You've come back to this neighborhood a number of times.
Oh, yeah.
Her daughter was here, just outside St. Louis, watching movies with her cousins when everyone woke up the next morning and discovered she was gone. She was 16 years old, a door was unlocked, and police believe she ran away, so they never searched for the girl.
They're not doing anything because they think she gone on her own. I don't know what to do.
This idea that she ran away, you don't believe that?
No. No. Do I believe she left her home with someone? Yes. But she was intending to come back. It was not intending to stay gone for 10 years.
Jeez. When I was a kid, I ran away, right? I was a bratty little kid, didn't like my mom disciplining me. I ran away. She called the cops. You know what the cops did? They started looking for me immediately.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This idea that a child is missing and if they had run away or if the cops think that they ran away, that they shouldn't investigate that? That's insane.
Yeah, it all goes down to... Again, thank you for doing this because I get emotional. It all goes down to the dehumanization of black and brown bodies, right? When you don't see those people as human, then it doesn't invoke the empathy in you to care about them. Anaya Blanchard was being abducted and a student at Auburn was being abducted at a gas station a couple of weeks ago. She was missing. Parents had to go on Instagram to launch some awareness because the media wasn't covering it. They just discovered her body. They come to find out that a white man saw it and reported it days later after he found out that there was some sort of reward, and only to explain that his wife told him, don't do anything about it. That's none of your business. Had they spoken up while that girl was being abducted at a gas station, she would probably be alive today. She's the daughter of a UFC fighter. We shouldn't have to say that for her body to matter. And that this is such a big issue in the Bronx, a bunch of Latin girls. If you notice how they classify with the Latinos are included in the whites, but then the black and the brown people, The children of color are not seen as human enough to be cared about so that their stories can matter when it comes to this. And we are going to have to use our voices and our platforms to help bring these children home, because outside of the Young Turks, who else is talking about this?
So the thing that like always comes to mind about everything you said is right. And I feel like I didn't really comprehend it until that video of Tamir Rice getting shot and killed within 2 seconds. I mean, you're talking about a 12-year-old kid. He's at a park. He's playing with a toy gun, you know, by the water. And a cop shows up and within 2 seconds, didn't ask a single question, shot and killed him, because that life didn't matter. Yeah. It didn't matter enough to stop and think, like, is that a real gun? Is that a toy gun? Is this person posing a threat to anyone? Doesn't matter. 12-year-old kid gone. Yeah. And that cop didn't face any consequences for it. It's devastating. So let's talk a little bit about the media and how they handle these types of stories. So there have been studies done to kind of gauge how often the media cover these types of stories, which child abduction cases they'll focus on, which ones they'll ignore. So there's a 2010 study that found that black children were significantly underrepresented in TV news. Even though about a third of all missing children in the FBI's database were black, they only made up about 20% of the missing children cases covered in the news. There was a more recent study in 2015. That study was bleaker. Though black children accounted for about 35% of missing children cases in the FBI's database, they amounted to only 7% of media references. And so when you don't pay attention to it, people don't know about it. And remember, it's important for the media to cover it, because if you see, let's say, the abductor's face, like a sketch of the abductor's face, mm-hmm. then you can be on the lookout. If you see what the missing girl or the missing person looks like, you can be on the lookout. If there's no media coverage on it, then how are members of the community going to know that there's a missing person that they should look out for?
I mean, just think about it. There's a national alert on our phones for a white girl that went missing, right? We have an Amber Alert, that it affects everybody in the country. It's not just regional, right? And you see this black girl a couple of weeks ago. She was driving in her car. She got carjacked. The guy threw her in the trunk of her car, went to the ATM machine and used her ATM card, was about to drive off with her. She did the newer cars have the thing in the trunk where you can open it, which you need to know. Opened the trunk, got out, ran into a business, and a man hit her in the back. But what, she would not have been a story on the news. The reason she was a story on the news is because she got out of the trunk and the cameras show her surviving in the moment. Mm-hmm. And it's so frustrating what is happening right now, because with this human trafficking, the sex, with the black market with the organs, and then with the human trafficking, and with people understanding that black women don't matter. R. Kelly can do it for 20 years. Mm-hmm. They don't matter enough because there are no consequences. There's no awareness. Why wouldn't they target them? Because they know that nothing's going to happen. And that is a big motivating force for criminals who are out here looking for the vulnerable, because they are in Compton. They are they're in the hood. They're in Houston. They're in Alabama. They are preying on people in marginalized communities because they feel ain't nobody going to go look for them girls. This is not going to be on the news. There ain't no Amber Alert for Shamika. That's a problem.
Yeah. And you just, I mean, I picture, I think of all those news stories where everyone's in a field, 6 feet apart, walking, looking for clues. Yep. And then they show the picture of the person who's missing, and it's always a white girl. And I feel cliched talking about, like, this girl fell down a well. It's like that was the movie of the week. Every week for like the entire 90s, mm-hmm. you know, and
yep,
it just
right.
doesn't change.
Mia, who's one of our members, wrote in while we've been covering the story and says, missing women of color is a huge issue in Canada too. Although although here the largest portion is with indigenous women and girls, and our media and government still refuse to speak up, much less act.
Oh yeah, there's a really big problem with the indigenous women, the murders of indigenous women, and without consequence.
Yeah, that was the summertime, but you know what comes with the summertime. Beef.
This is KCUR 89.3. Barbecue is a huge part of Kansas City's identity. But for many Black Kansas Cityans, having cookouts as part of community and bonding is tradition, too. KCUR's Michelle Tyrene Johnson examines how cutting back on meat as part of climate change could impact communal eating.
In the Black community, summer cookouts with music and family and friends, beef and pork on the grill is a cultural staple. But cutting back on meat is one of the ways experts say that we can all help with climate change. Gigi Jones, also known as Gigi the Vegan, says that for the Black community, all the plant-based meat substitutions out there should make the transition easier. Jones, who's Black, counsels people on how to eat better to live better. She likes to teach people that the meat might change, but the flavor and the tradition doesn't have to.
I can still have my food the same way. I can still have my burgers. I can still have my fries. We can still grill out and cook out and have fun and chit-chat it up and show each other love. Oh, yeah, put that Frank and Beverly back on. Let's get it.
While she primarily focuses on health, Jones knows that it's good for the planet, too. She also knows that convincing her fellow Black people to pay more attention to climate change issues requires telling people they can just cut back. They don't have to completely cut out hamburgers, hot dogs, and ribs.
I'm not one of those radical vegans. I'm really not. It's my own personal journey, but I do try to help people to get to understand the impact that it has on our environment.
Jones was diagnosed with colon cancer in 2015. She attributes her decision to go vegan to being a great part of why she is a cancer-free diagnosis today. She says one of the ways to appeal to more Black people is using more inclusive messaging, which is why she called her first vegan festival the Soul Veg Fest. She says about 2,000 people attended.
And the language has to be there for us to say, oh, this is for us. Oh, they're talking about us. Oh, and so when I use social media, when I use certain tools now, I make sure that that language is not racially biased.
Livestock emissions likely play a role in climate change. And Timothy Searchinger, a professor and researcher at Princeton University, says while it's complicated, the bottom line is that the world is warming faster than it should.
And what's causing it to warm is the increase of greenhouse gas.
Searchinger spoke with me from Sweden, where he was meeting with meat producers. He says part of the connection between meat consumption and climate change boils down to the use of land.
Beef is the most land-hungry form of food. And basically, for the world to be able to feed itself without clearing dramatically more forests, the wealthy have to moderate their demand.
According to the Department of Agriculture, the average American eats more than 220 pounds of meat a year. Searchinger says that compared to the rest of the world, wealthy includes America's poor when it comes to meat consumption.
I mean, if everybody in the world ate as much beef as the average American, we basically need another planet.
Nicole Jackson from Olathe attended Soul Veg Fest because she's trying to make the turn to vegan. It's about health and it's about helping the environment. Jackson says that opening the door to a different way of eating can sometimes just be as simple as exposure. For example, some Black folks may not know much about a kale salad when they're used to cooked collard and turnip greens.
A lot of times these things happen because we don't have the experience with other foods. We're very restricted to what we're open to.
Jackson says climate change should be more of a concern to everyone than it is now.
Letting go of tradition are pretty much held in place by dead people.
Those cookouts with loved ones are part of Black community traditions. Traditions that some who are concerned about the environment want to make sure that future generations of Black friends and family, along with the rest of the world, can enjoy. For KCUR 89.3, I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson.
Things have happened. It's amazing when I talk to people and they say, man, I've been seeing folks protest and nothing has happened. When in reality, there are 40 new laws in 24 states. you would not have the number of police departments, body cameras.
3 years, three mayors, and a cascade of missed deadlines in Nashville. Police officers in Tennessee's capital still are not wearing body cameras, despite promises to do just that. In the meantime, there have been two high-profile police shootings. Samantha Max of member station WPLN reports.
This story unofficially begins on October 30th, 2016. Then-Mayor Megan Berry stood at the pulpit of Temple Church in Nashville and made a promise.
What we will do, Chief Anderson and I, we will be in a position to recommend full funding for all police officers to have body cameras when we present next year's budget to the Metro Council.
From that moment on, Berry's administration seemed to move full steam ahead. She convened a task force to research body camera programs across the country and draft a policy. But even at the group's first meeting, activist Clemmy Greenlee wondered whether the city was really ready for body cameras.
I want to make sure that we be assured that we won't be sitting here this time next year talking about the same one object, the body camera.
Flash forward 3 years and two mayors later. The police department still hasn't bought a single body camera.
Where's the money? Where's the money? Where's the money?
This week, protesters gathered outside the mayor's office demanding answers. Some top officials say Berry made a hasty promise that would prove too expensive to keep. And then priorities shifted as power changed hands, twice in less than 2 years. And while other police departments around the country have slowly phased in body cameras, Nashville pledged to buy them all at once. Here's Chief Steve Anderson.
The total request associated with cameras would be $50.1 million.
Let's rewind to 2017. Jacques Clemens had just been shot and killed after a traffic stop, and activists demanded police reform. They wanted interactions between officers and civilians caught on camera. But at a budget hearing, Chief Anderson said there was no room for shortcuts. There's the price of each individual camera, and the cost to store thousands of hours of video they'll capture each day, plus salaries for new employees who will review all that footage before it's released to the public or used at trial.
I've never made a request during my tenure for any funding that any way approaches that, but we've never taken on something as complicated and expensive as this camera project.
Then Daniel Hambrick was killed last year, again after a traffic stop. It wasn't until this past August that the city signed a contract with a camera vendor and promised a quick rollout. Weeks later, another bump in the road. District Attorney Glenn Funk said officials hadn't taken into consideration the ripple effect body cameras would have across the legal system. Marcus Floyd says this is all just a delaying tactic. He worked for the last mayor and believes Nashville can't wait any longer.
It can't be a priority because there's another black body on the streets. We need to make sure that body cameras are deployed before there's another life lost in this city.
The new mayor, John Cooper, has now set another deadline. He hopes to have a plan in place by the end of this year. For NPR News, I'm Samantha Max in Nashville.
Carmichael and other SNCC members began a voter drive in Lowndes County, Alabama, known as Bloody Lowndes for its violence against blacks. Although 80% of the population was black, there were no black elected officials. Economically dependent on white plantation owners, many were afraid to join civil rights efforts, and none had been allowed to register to vote until early 1965.
In Alabama, funeral services are scheduled today for Big John Williams. He was a popular sheriff allegedly killed by the son of a deputy from a neighboring county. Williams is the fifth law enforcement officer killed by gunfire in Alabama this year, the highest number in at least 6 years. His death has resonated nationwide. Janae Pierre from member station WBHM has more.
He stood 6'4", more than 260 pounds, with a deep voice. Residents in Alabama say Sheriff Big John Williams lived up to his name, not just in stature, but with his heart. He spent 4 decades working in law enforcement and the last 9 years as sheriff of Lowndes County. Williams, a black man, was fatally shot more than a week ago at a gas station in Hainesville, outside of Montgomery. He was responding to a complaint about people blocking gas pumps with their cars and playing loud music. It was a call many officers say wasn't unusual. The suspect, 18-year-old William Chase Johnson, is charged with murder and is being held without bond. But few details surrounding the shooting have been released.
For sheriff,
Sunday morning, dozens of people marched on a main city street to demand justice for the slain 62-year-old sheriff. Haynesville Police Chief Kelvin Mitchell, Williams' close friend, was one of the leaders of the march.
Ain't thinking about no conflict. This is about justice. I don't have a conflict with anybody.
Mitchell says the investigation is being handled by the Alabama Law Enforcement Agency and the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office.
You got a young white kid that takes the life of the highest law enforcement official in the county, and there's no outcry. Nobody's saying anything.
Mitchell says state officials are trying to change the narrative, saying the sheriff wasn't on duty at the time and didn't follow proper procedure, including, they say, failing to identify himself as law enforcement. Williams was on the scene responding to a call from someone at the gas station.
They're saying he wasn't on duty. The sheriff's on duty 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 a year.
Many Lowndes County residents can attest to Mitchell's statement. Most say Williams was always on duty, and many had a cell phone number. Walter Hill is a former county official. He spoke to a crowd of nearly 50 at the march about the sheriff's accessibility in the community.
Mothers could pick up the phone when their child was being disorderly. Teachers and principals, you name it, all they had to say, let me call Big John.
Stuart Harold is one of the owners of the gas station where Williams was killed. He says the sheriff would stop by as often as 3 times a day just to check in.
Every morning, he would ride by and toot his horn, and you can ask all the businesses. He would wait until you waved at him, and then he'd leave every morning about 5 o'clock.
Harold says Williams was a symbol of what a leader in law enforcement should be. He says Williams will be missed by all.
I bet you if you go down to the jail, all the inmates are going to miss him. He meant that much to everybody. Everybody.
Alabama Governor Kay Ivey has ordered flags to be flown at half-staff today in memory of Sheriff Big John Williams. His funeral will take place this morning at a Montgomery Coliseum that seats more than 10,000 people. For NPR News, I'm Janae Pierre in Haynesville, Alabama.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
New at 5, a Southwest suburban mom says her son was the victim of a hate crime at school and that district officials are not taking the proper steps to ensure his safety.
WGN's Dana Rubick is live in Minooka with the story for us tonight. Dana?
And this mother has had 3 older children go through the school system here, and she tells us they all experienced some form of racism on campus, but nothing like this.
It started out as small comments. He has been called the N-word by the student.
To Saxton Washington says her son, a senior at Minooka High School, was in class just before Thanksgiving break, the teacher out of the room when the same student's behavior escalated.
When my son went to reach for a cookie that this young man brought in, loudly above everyone in the classroom so that everyone could hear him, he yelled, "If you touch my cookie, I will lynch you."
Administration was made aware of the incident that same day, multiple students calling into an anonymous tip line at school to report the comment. Washington met with a dean and assistant principal, telling them she wanted the student in question expelled the next day.
That is when I was informed that he was only going to be suspended for 10 days and that the school resource officer had not contacted the police department, that we were going to have to do that.
If you don't call this what it is, then you can never fix it. This is a hate crime.
Attorney Cannon Lambert says from a legal perspective, there are specific steps school staff members failed to take.
The school resource officer should have taken this and presented it to the police department so that a report was generated, and thereafter the state's attorney could look at it and determine whether or not a charge should be brought. That didn't happen.
The district did send us this statement saying that administration took immediate action to investigate and administer appropriate discipline to the student involved. That the district encourages any students who feel harassed or threatened to report the incident to administration, teachers, counselors, or deans so the matter can be dealt with swiftly and appropriately.
When someone tells you that they're going to lynch you, that means I'm going to kill you. So, therefore, I am afraid for my son's safety. So I was advised to.
We did follow up and ask the school district why a police report wasn't generated and why it wasn't passed along to the Grundy County State's Attorney's Office. They responded saying they had no additional comment. Now, this child's mother says she does plan to meet with district officials again. She's not taking legal action yet, but she does want to file a restraining order against this child, who is expected to return to school in a few days. Live in Manuka, Dana Rebick, WGN News.
So Dana, just to be clear, her son is still in school after this incident, right?
Yes, her son is still in school. They just returned from Thanksgiving break on Monday, and this other student is expected to return to school shortly after this 10-day suspension.
All right, thank you, Dana.
I've seen what's around the corner. I've seen what's over the horizon, and I promise you, you niggas have nothing to celebrate. And no, I won't get there with you. I'm going to Canada.
A major health scare in Ontario is raising important questions tonight about how visible minorities are treated in medicine. CTV's medical specialist Avis Favreau has the harrowing story of a musician with a mysterious condition that took months of consultations and an entire community to diagnose. You
underestimated greatly. Canadian rapper John Rivers says he endured a medical nightmare.
I'll call it a failure of the healthcare system.
He went to the hospital December of 2017 feeling very ill. No one, he says, took him seriously. It took five visits until doctors tested him, including removing a fluid sample from his spine. And that's when the headaches began.
It's the incredible crushing feeling that I had on the back of my neck for over 60 days, you know? And I was trying to express myself, but, you know, at that juncture, I was slurring.
For the next 2 months, Rivers says he was given the runaround at hospitals and clinics. He says in some cases, he was wrongly labeled depressed and an addict.
I mean, some of the comments, for instance, drug usage. I answered the question. The physician said to me, I don't believe you.
Meanwhile, his headaches were intensifying.
This pain is like, it's incredible. And I was passing out all the time.
Only when his family issued a plea on Twitter did he find a doctor who diagnosed a spinal fluid leak from that earlier test. It had left his brain sagging in his skull and could have been easily repaired months earlier. Now, after 8 months of rehab, John River is raising questions about racism in medicine.
No doubt feel that it absolutely had to do with the fact that I was a young black man.
Heard about it not only from my patients, but also from family members.
This doctor says racism exists in healthcare and harms patients.
So it is certainly a problem, but I think one of the biggest problems is that we're not able to collect data to demonstrate it.
So now John River has a new goal alongside his music, to become an advocate for equality in healthcare.
Only thing that's on my mind every day is how much pain I went through, and knowing to myself, I could never, never consciously allow somebody else to go through what I went through.
And the rapper says he's also considering a lawsuit and a human rights complaint, Omar, about his medical care.
Eye-opening report. All right, Avis, thank you.
These assholes, they always get away.
George Zimmerman, the Florida man who shot and killed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in 2012, is back in the news. Zimmerman was acquitted of homicide in connection with the killing, but he is now suing Martin's family, the family's attorney, and a law enforcement agency for more than $100 million. The suit claims that Zimmerman was the victim of a conspiracy and malicious prosecution, and that he has been defamed. Now, while the merits of the suit and the eye-catching demands have been widely reported, one detail has not been. Zimmerman's lawyer. He's being represented by Larry Klayman, who is known for prolific filing of lawsuits in support of long-debunked conspiracy theories. For example, he spent years denouncing President Obama as a closet Muslim who was not born in the United States. We wanted to learn more about Larry Klayman and his work, so we've called on Heidi Byrick. She leads the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, which publishes its Hate Watch blog, and she is with us now from her office in Alabama. Heidi, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the Southern Poverty Law Center, as we said, tracks hate and extremist groups in the United States. And you have extensive information on your website about Larry Klayman. Can you just begin by telling us why you started following his work?
Yeah, well, it really started in the early 2000s as he was beginning to attack the candidate Obama and started looking into Obama's as part of the birther conspiracy, this idea that Obama wasn't born in the United States. But once we started looking at him, we realized that his conspiracy mongering went further back into the 1990s, and he's basically kept it up until the present day. Just in the very recent past, he held a grand jury convened on his own to indict Robert Mueller related to the Mueller investigation into Donald Trump. So these activities continue.
So he's often identified as a gadfly, which I think implies that he's, you know, kind of harmless or perhaps a bit eccentric. But how do you see it?
Well, I don't think that he's harmless. He's a gadfly in the sense that he seems to attach himself to every kind of controversy involving anti-government extremists. For example, he tried to represent Cliven Bundy, who was a rancher in Nevada who brought a bunch of militia types and anti-government extremists to his ranch in an attempt to repel a federal effort to reclaim cattle from him. He hadn't paid his cattle fees in forever. And whenever there's a high-profile situation like that, it seems like Klayman shows up to represent somebody who is also involved in conspiracy mongering. And, you know, the gadfly issue also relates to the Zimmerman case here because it's making headlines. And here we find Klayman again accusing there of having been some kind of, you know, controversy in the courts, and he's making a big stink about this, and he's basing it on a video that was put out by a guy who works at InfoWars, right? One of the biggest conspiracy sites in the world.
The family, through their attorney Ben Crump, who's also been named in the suit, has basically called this cruel, noting that George Zimmerman has been acquitted and is a free man, but they have to live with the loss of their son, and they basically say this is cruel. How do you think Americans should view this suit and the coverage that it is likely to bring about?
I think the lawsuit is shameless and it is cruel, and it's putting this family back having to relive the loss of their son, and it's outrageous, and it's probably being done to drum up funds for Klayman's own organization and to propel himself into the press. And it's just an extremely cynical way to draw attention to Klayman. But, you know, he's not above that. This has been his track record now for 30 years.
That's Heidi Byrick, Intelligence Project Director for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Heidi Byrick, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, December 7, 2019. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, counter-racist suggestions you would like to share. The number for the broadcast, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Few things before we get to our listeners. One, Clifford Thompson, he should be on the program. He wrote the book What It Is. I think we played an audio segment a few days back, not that long ago. He did research on Trump supporters, whites, white men specifically, exclusively, who voted for or are planning to vote for President Trump. And his book just came out a few weeks back. He said it kind of changed his thought process about racism and even how some other victims of racism think or talk about racism, white supremacy. He should be with us in a few days if you want to check out his book in preparation, Black Male, but I was intrigued just with his study, even why he excluded white women from the study. Lots of things stood out, but I am looking forward to chatting it up. Should be here soon. His book just got mailed to me. Looking forward to beginning that as well. Next, the first audio segment we started with tonight, the feature with the the feature with the parents, but it wasn't, where the principal sounded like a white woman at the school where she started going through some of her students' social media feeds, and it seemed there was some sort of predator, adult predator, child rapist potentially, who was using social media to stalk these male students. Again, I don't have children, but there's a lot to be mindful of if you are an attempted parent in terms of potential dangers and different ways that your child can be harmed in the system of racism. We've talked about the amount of pedophilia and child sexual molestation of children that occurs in the system of racism that seems to be promoted almost in the system of racism, white supremacy. Social media is, you know, a whole nother element that you would need to be mindful of. I don't even know if I would want my child to have a social media account if they're 9, 10, 11. Hey, even if you have a 59-year-old child, maybe they shouldn't have a social media account. Dr. Cambon did say that, but yeah, see if you can prolong that for a while. I mean, if you're going to have it, that is an extra burden to be, you know, really alert, really vigilant about who is contacting your child. There are lots and lots of child rapists. Next, the segment about Rosa Parks. I had many thoughts. Number one, I began that segment. I played Erykah Badu, a song from one of her previous releases, and the lyrics, she says, "You won't be naming no buildings after me. My name will be misstated, surely." Very accurate. Victim of white supremacy, Erykah Badu. And I feel like that's done pretty regularly with victims of white supremacy, where particularly victims of white supremacy who've made an effort to fight against the system, where once you are dead, sometimes they might have to wait a while, might have to wait, you know, a decade, 50 years or so after you've been dead. Then they will put you on a stamp or name a building after you or something, and they will deliberately omit aspects of your life and work that do not support the system of racism or reveal truth about what it means to be white. They will conveniently expunge all of that and just, you know, decide how they want to present your image. That was number one. It's done. We've talked about this on a pretty consistent basis. I think they do this with Minister Malcolm X, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Nelson Mandela, pretty much any non-white person you can think of who has worked to fight against racism, white supremacy, and most certainly with Rosa Parks. We talked about this before. We talked about this earlier this week with Harriet Tubman. We had suspected race soldier Dr. Elizabeth Cobbs on the program. And again, having whites control and be the author authority on how a black person is going to be presented to the world. So that was one thought. When you get into the clip and they begin, I believe it's a black curator of the exhibit, thankfully, even though that doesn't even help sometimes. But they start off with, hey, Rosa Parks, she sat with her grandfather. She wanted to see him kill a Kluxer. I read a portion of that from a biography on Rosa Parks some years back when we had a different white person who was deliberately omitting and minimizing the life and works of Rosa Parks. I pointed out then she did not just begin her efforts in the 1950s. She had been doing this for a long time. Scottsboro Boys, we just talked about that. We were reading the biography on Paul Robeson. Rosa Parks was in the 1930s going around trying to help black people who had been accused of raping a white woman, or black people who had been raped by a white person, often black females, with that work. But she had been doing that sort of thing for a long period of time. And to just have her efforts reduced to, oh, she sat down, even her sitting down, that itself was connected to her work and even the castration lynching of Emmett Till. 1955, that had a huge impact on her. That was just a few months later on, as it did for many black people at that time period. That had an enormous impact. And as someone who was as focused on solving the problem as Rosa Parks was, certainly she would have been paying attention to all the details about that case. Mississippi is right there next to Alabama where she was. So it had a huge impact. And she said that even had a direct impact on her, you know, choosing to not get up that day. So I think, you know, it's great to get all that information out. On the one hand, some of this information is available in books already. When they got to the words, always talk about words, compensatory call-in, feisty, radical, militant. Feisty stood out immediately. I often, every time I hear that word, I pause. I often hear like small animals, kittens, pets described as feisty, tiny dogs. It's not a term I would use to describe someone who, for decades, sacrificed her life, could have been killed at any time, easily, in Alabama. Easily. Bloody Loudons, that's what they called it. Birmingham, these are the nicknames for the area where Rosa Parks hung out, Alabama. Some of our callers hang out there now. These are the nicknames that they would label for these regions of terrorism. She could have been killed easily at any time. That's what you heard. Grandfather got to sit out on the porch. It's dangerous. Racists might come through any time, try to kill us. If that's the life that you are leading, that sort of danger should be front and center. But that's not feisty. Someone choosing to fight back against that, risk being killed, that is not feisty. In my view, that is not militant or radical either. Those two words stood out. And anyone who's listened to the cows for any length of time, you've heard me talk about those words before. I have been described as militant and radical. I think it's pejorative every time if it's a white person or a non-white person, especially if it's a white person, calling me radical in the system of racism, white supremacy. I'm a bit of a slacker, I will admit. I had not checked completely Mr. Fuller's word guide to see, wait a minute, is militant, is radical, are these terms in the word guide? Absolutely, both of them are militant. Let's see what Mr. Fuller has to say. Avoid using this word, underlined. When others use it, ask for a detailed explanation that you can easily understand. Questions. What exactly is a militant? What exactly is not a militant? Is it correct to say that a militant is any person, creature, or spirit that is willing to fight? If so, what exactly is fighting? What exactly is not fighting? Are there different ways to fight? How many different ways can a person be a militant? Is it ever correct for a person to be a militant? If so, when? Where? How? As it pertains to what? Is defending oneself from being mistreated the same thing as being militant? Beautiful question. What is the difference between being civil and being militant? Is a civil war a militant activity? If so, how can it be civil and militant at the same time? If so, how can a war be civil, civilized? Is telling the truth the same as being militant? Another important question. Is a law enforcement officer militant? Is a person militant if he or she kills another person in self-defense? Is a white supremacist racist militant? is a person who seeks to replace white supremacy with justice, a militant. We didn't even get to radical yet. Let's see what that one says. Radical, use this word with caution. When others use it, ask for a detailed explanation that you can easily understand. Questions. What exactly is radical? In each area of activity, what exactly is not radical? Radical, according to whom? Who exactly is correctly qualified to say what is and what is not radical? Radical when? Radical where? Radical according to what? As compared to what? Is slavery radical? Is getting rid of slavery radical? Is freedom, in quotes, a radical idea? Is white supremacy racism a radical way for people to interact with each other? Is it radical to attempt to eliminate white supremacy racism and replace it with justice, balance between people? Note, during the existence of white supremacy racism and according to compensatory counter-racist logic, the most radical political system in the known universe is the system of white supremacy. Absolutely. But those words, they were used repeatedly throughout the segment. And I've heard that with others. Madiba, myself, Madiba, many others, where they'll be labeled as militant, radical. And consistently, in my view, all of that is to minimize, to reduce the validity of your views, your actions, your perspective on white supremacy, race. And go back to that question. Are racists, white supremacists, radical, militant? And the other aspect with Rosa Parks, from my studies and understanding of Rosa Parks, she was kind of a private person. She wasn't, you know, gregarious, you know, I want to come and tell you everything about my life story and talk about, you know, me for the next. That was not the type of person that she was, unless I've been misinformed. I don't know how she would feel about having her yoga mat and all of this material exposed. And while the system of white supremacy still exists, I guess a lot of things I could say about that segment, I'll conclude. When they were talking about the dress, the yoga mat and all that, and as a yoga instructor, oh, wow, Rosa Parks was a yogi too. That's amazing. But I'd be okay if I didn't know that bit of information, because I know she's kind of a private person. But when they got to the dress and going into all the details, she liked wearing pink and blah, 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 and all that. Is this exhibit, is this about inspiring us to continue her work to replace white supremacy with justice? Or is this about something else? Because I don't think admiring like her interest in fashion and wardrobe, everybody, or many people wear clothes. Many people have clothing articles that they like. Nothing against that. But I mean, if replacing white supremacy with justice seemed to be the guiding inspiration throughout Rosa Parks' life, then I would want to make sure that every aspect of this exhibit reflects and hopefully transfers that inspiration to the non-white people who see it. Not, oh, she was really into fashion. Pink was her favorite color. Maybe I need to see the exhibit. Maybe it's one of those. Next. They report on the correlation between cancer and chemically mutilating your hair. Immediately was reminded of Miss Zanelli, a UK participant on the program some years back, repeatedly on the program where we talked about how you manage your hair as a component of counter-racism and not chemically mutilating your hair. Words are important. She said, let's not say straighten and use all these other pussyfooting verbiage, chemically mutilating your hair. That was a big component of what we talked about, just saying, let's do what's healthy. Let's get away from putting all these chemicals and mutilating ourselves let's just do what's healthy. How about that? Dick Gregory, I know, has talked about that for a long time as well, putting all those chemicals, and that those chemicals would have to seep into your scalp, your skin, that it would be, you know, horrible idea for all of that. But was reminded of that language. Words are important. Self-care, super important. Reminded of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, natural hair for the entire time. Pam talked about that, how important it was, her doing her counter-racist work, talking about black self-respect, and then having the hair to match. Black self-respect for the duration, and even her sister coming on the program and talking about her transition to being able to do that. Super important. But I did thought it was crucial to get that in as well. Let's see. I guess the last thing I'll get in for the time being, the segment that we concluded with, Trayvon Martin's murderer. They talked about his legal representation. Larry Klayman, suspected race soldier. And they mentioned the different folks who were reporting there. They mentioned he also represented Clive and Bundy. Folks don't remember Clive and Bundy, the rancher in Arizona. He on video, I bet you can pull it up on YouTube, where he was talking to a reporter and he said, let me tell you what I've learned from my years of studying the Negro. And that's how he said it too. He said Negro too. And this is like 2014, 2015, in the middle of all of that, where they had all the whites out with their guns and what have you. So that was one. And then they said that he also was a part of this, Obama, President Obama, he's a Muslim. That was a part of, you know, how President Trump, well, how he became President Trump. He's a Muslim and he's not a citizen. You know, we need to see his birth certificate. See this nigger's papers. Now, if I had one white person who you're representing Clive and Bundy, you're representing Trayvon Martin's murderer, and you think President Obama is a Muslim and might not be an American citizen, I would, as Dr. Welsing would say, metaphor, but I'm just invoking her language, she would say, I'm going to connect the dots here. This seems like someone where there's a correlation. Racism, white supremacy, with all of these people who are flagrantly against non-white people, black people. Oh, suspected racist. But they didn't say that in the segment. They called him a gadfly. Now, I have heard that term used before. I could pick out other time. That's another one that I hear frequently will be applied to people like yours truly, Nelson Mandela, Assata Shakur, Mumia Abu-Jamal. Ugh, got this nigga talking about racism. Ugh, scadfly. Instead of that, if they're out in public, as opposed to, ugh, this nigga talking about racism. Al Sharpton, I'm sure if you do a Google search, Al Sharpton gadfly, it'll pop up. But I can't call him a nigga right now because we're in, you know, the front stage, as they say, it'll be a gadfly. Maybe a militant. A radical. And then once we get out, this nigga's here talking about racism. Ugh. But yeah, they called him a gadfly. Larry Klayman. What is that? Have to go, and then they even went back. Well, yeah, he's a gadfly in the sense. What does that even mean? You mean a suspected racist? Oh, okay. Now I got you. Anything else? Oh, wait, that words are important. In fact, I will. This is the one broadcast where I request weekly. We could not use metaphors. We had quite a few of them. There, I was going to say gadfly is a metaphor, but that's a noun. That actually is in the dictionary. But the way that it's used, basically, it is a metaphor. But there were a number of them anyway. They said that Rosa Parks, she still had a hand in the game. I don't even know what that means. But again, if we're talking about the same Rosa Parks who was using her time and energy to try to replace white supremacy with justice, where she could have been killed at any time, where biographies talk about she lost her job, her husband lost his job, her mother lost her job, and they were in total poverty and didn't know what was going to happen. And while this was happening, financial ruin, they were being terrorized with whites calling them and leaving messages daily, sometimes hourly. Nigga, we're going to kill gadfly. We're going to kill you. We're going to kill you. You and your family. We're going to kill you. Where she was having almost a nervous breakdown. That's how they ended up moving to Michigan. They couldn't stay in Alabama anymore. They were terrorized. Man, if that's what we're talking about, no, I'm not going to say that she kept a hand in the game for her entire life. I'm going to say for the entire time that she was on this planet, She fought against the system of white supremacy and tried to replace it with a system of justice. That's what I'm trying to say. Not she had a hand in there. What does that even mean? Then they had, we had another one. Well, it was a bunch of them. I'm just picking out a few. They talked about in Nashville, they were going to get the body cameras. And they said they got going, and then they hit a bump in the road. System of racism, any of that language, you want specifics where something was supposed to happen and didn't, and it is to the detriment of black people. You do not want a lot of pussyfooting and vague verbiage. You want exact details. Why are we not getting the body cameras? Not, oh, there was a bump in the road. It was a snack. Be mindful of all, because people will come up with a lot of really bizarre, unique phrases when speaking about racism, white supremacy, and how to solve this problem. A lot of times these phrases will be deliberate to avoid talking directly about racism, white supremacy. As such, for this here broadcast specifically, if we could not use metaphors, racists will use terminology like that often deliberately to obfuscate, deceive. Master deceivers, frequently they'll take two entities and insist that these two separate entities are identical, exactly the same. And frequently that's not the case at all. Often victims of white supremacy, myself included, we have been mistreated, deceived. We've been subjected to this misconduct for a long time. And then a lot of us, we are still learning. As such, sometimes there are specific topics. We don't have all of the logic to articulate our views, which is fine. But we'll substitute a metaphor, analogy of some sort, and frequently that will just produce a lot more confusion. If we could make an effort to be exact, explicit, precise with what we want to say, that would be super appreciated. We'll prompt about the metaphors. Folks could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, questions, counter-racist suggestions. That would be great. Just make sure everyone gets at least one opportunity to speak. If you need more than five, if you could just be patient, allow everyone to get their 5 minutes. And then if you have additional questions or thoughts, we should have time for you to share. If you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just helps to preserve the audio quality of the program. We don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary racket in the background. You can unmute when you're ready to speak. Hopefully you can be in a quieter area, share your thoughts, and then mute yourself. And then if you want to hop back on, say anything else, unmute. You should be able to share. Much obliged for your cooperation. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed. Let's see. Having can some audio difficulties myself. Yikes. Thomas in New York. Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the callers. Thanks for the show. Thanks for the white guest this week. Very good. Much appreciated. The report came out this week about dopamine. about dopamine fasting. Growing trend amongst employees of the big tech companies at Silicon Valley. They take vacations where they're totally offline and no social media, no internet access. It was reported a year ago that tech company executives do not allow their children to go to technically advanced schools or possess products that they make, like iPads and cell phones and things like that. Another report came out a long time ago, a few years ago, that receiving a like on Facebook or a thumb up on YouTube or vice versa, thumb up, down, you know, a dislike, it had the same dopamine release on your brain as doing a line of cocaine. The brain includes several dopamine pathways. Some play a major role in the motivational components of the reward-motivated behavior. The anticipation of the reward increases the level of dopamine in our brains. Many addictive drugs increase dopamine release or block the reuptake into the neurons fast following the release. So when they monitored monkeys, they gave the monkeys a button to press, and when they pressed the button, they got a treat or a reward. And would, they monitored their brains while they did this. And what they realized was that when they took the reward away, the treat away, they would still stand there and press the button. And the same effect was happening on their brain, because what it was they was anticipating the drug. It wasn't so much as them getting high or getting the treat. It was the anticipation of it. Most people wake up, they go to sleep with their phone in their hand, they check everything, they wake up, check their emails, check their Facebook, whatever they do, anticipating. We become addicted to these devices. And it was very interesting that the tech companies' employees take weeks off at a time on vacation where they go places where it's totally internet free. So that way they're not even able to get online if they wanted to. It's very interesting. They did that same study on rats. And the rats would sit there and push the button. And when they stopped giving them the treat, they would actually sit there and push the button until they died without eating or doing any other things that they needed to survive, because they, every time they pressed the button, they were getting that release of dopamine, anticipating something in return, and it killed them. Baltimore Mayor Jack Young tweeted, "We're getting reports of someone in a white man trying to snatch up young girls for human trafficking and for selling body parts, I'm told. So we have to really be careful, because they're doing so much evil, not just the city of Baltimore, but around the country," said Young. So that was a report by the mayor of Baltimore to his citizens. Now, you see a lot of these body snatchings and people coming up missing. A lot of this is for white people entertainment on places like the dark web, where you could have a room with a black girl and you could watch her get gang raped or totally mutilated, you know, for the entertainment purposes of white people. And, you know, a lot of this is, like they say, stealing organs. So it's, I'm glad that someone's bringing attention to it. I think it was just a year ago they had the same similar report in D.C. Baltimore and D.C. are the same area. Uber reported this week, Gus, 2017 and 2018, they released some of the reports. So these were the statistics. Non-consensual touching of sexual body parts. In 2017, they had 1,440. In 2018, they had 1,560. Non-consensual kissing of non-sexual body parts, 2017, 570. 2018, 594. Non-consensual kissing of a body part, 390. 2017, 376. in 2018. Attempted non-consensual penetration, 307 in 2017, 280 in 2018. And lastly, non-consensual sexual penetration, which is actual rape, 229 in 2017 and 235 in 2018. Total incidents, 2017, 2,936. 2018, 3,045 total incidents of sexual misconduct by Uber drivers. In some of these cases, it was the passengers doing it to the drivers as well. And this is just what's been reported. So this is, to me, another component of these young people coming up missing. But a lot of reports of people getting in the Uber cars and never coming back. And, you know, who knows what's the agenda behind that. But just be very careful. People with young children and women, if you catch an Uber, maybe make sure you have someone on speed dial that you can reach. If you find that they're going a different route or something, just be very vigilant. The body cameras, I don't think that it stops police-involved shootings.
30
However,
seconds.
The numbers have, because 850, the Washington Post reported for 2019 police-involved shootings. I still believe that the numbers have gone down. By Welzen, when she came on the show, Gus, she said that it was an Obama as the president, which was causing the numbers to go up because white people weren't happy with that. And I'm getting my line of thinking.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. Very important about the probably white tech workers getting their time to abstain from social media or being online and all the rest of it. Important. It's, with even in the report they were talking about, the people who do the editing at YouTube, they have counselors for them. I thought that was important too. A lot of times they'll have black people where all kinds of things happen to us and we don't get counseling, but just watching social media content and sanitizing social media content, you get counseling. Other folks who dialed in, greetings, Emmy. If you have commentary to share, *61. Line should be open.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I hope everyone's having the best evening they can. I appreciate the clips. I guess my awareness became heightened when I heard the word feisty as related to Rosa Parks, because I've used that word in the past, and I just did not think that word referred to her. I looked it up, and the origin of the word, according to Merriam-Webster, is talking about a small dog. I said, well, I guess I have to stop using that word as it pertains to black people. That's why I use it a lot, but just as it pertains to black people, I'm going to have to give that, going to have to stop that. So I appreciate that. And I thought it was weird that they thought her behavior as a child was different than her behavior as an adult. It seemed in line. To me, it just seemed in line. It seemed like she may have become, as we say, sometimes more refined in her execution, which would make sense because you grow up, you learn more things, you learn more ways to do things. You may not always go to the violent way as you would as a young person, but you still have to get things done, and you would learn and grow and become more educated, refined, learn the legal system, learn words, as we talk about learning words, and execute things in a different way. So it made sense to me that she did one thing when she was young and grew and learned and sat on the bus, and, you know, she was more than tired. Even if she was just tired, deciding to do that was an important act and a dangerous one, you know. So I appreciate her bravery, you know, in that area. And about the hair, I heard about the hair on the Today Show. And I think, I guess speaking to that, the importance of, I guess, black people being in the journalism field, because it was brought up by a black person, and they were saying that it was 9%. Then they broke it out between black people and white people, and it was very different. I think it was 7% and 45%. That might have been what was said in the what you played. And I remember that. I was like, oh, I think I should talk about that. So I'm glad. I was like, oh, look, it came up. And then you think about the numbers, because I've done some research. I mean, I've had some classes in statistics and, you know, thinking about the number of people involved in this, in the survey, and the how it was skewed, so that out of all the people, it would be 9% total, which is relatively, which seems low, and 45% for black people, black women, because it was women, and, you know, the numbers involved with that. So I kind of think about those things, the mathematics, or the actual numbers involved as well, and things about these women, as other things about these women and conflating, and you have to be careful when you talk about things, because they always say correlation and practical everyday language. People who are not into that is causation. It implies causation. They can't say that, I guess, for legal reasons. And I was taught when I took statistics, you never really say causation. You say correlation. So you'll hear that a lot. And I think that's... Oh, and I heard a little bit of the Savage, the student, the young person. I don't know what they're supposed to be. And a lot of the things they said were true, especially pertaining to school. I remember getting into the school that I got into. You had to take a special test. And I don't know how, well, my parents, they both were black, divorced, but they went together because they were my parents. And they, you know, despite their divorce, they were my parents, so they were together on things. They went to the school for parent-teacher conference, normal parent-teacher conference, and I had good grades. I wasn't a problem student at the time. So the guidance counselor, who I never met, never saw, I don't know if this person is black or white, I know nothing about this person, recommended that I go on to the high school that I went to in New York, and it was a specialized high school. And my cousin went to the same school. He was a year ahead of me, and he had my aunt, who was involved in my education, because we went to the same elementary school. It was instrumental in getting me into the middle school that I went to.
30 seconds.
And somehow he didn't get that information. So I think it is important. Although I didn't have one white parent, it is important as a parent to be diligent, and sometimes you don't know why those things happen, but you have to be diligent and look around and be aware of opportunities for your children. Thank you.
Well said. Well said. Be vigilant for attempted parents. See, right as you were saying that, although I don't have a white parent, I have someone to look out for potential opportunities. I looked and Azora Savage popped up in the call line. I said, how about that? Cowbell there too. Always good to see her, folks in Seattle. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks with a hand up, if you have comments, suggestions, questions to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Imhan DC.
Yes, sir. Greetings. So, I'm not driving.
Wonderful.
Hopefully. Yeah, not today. So, hopefully the audio doesn't get cut out or muted or lowered. But I did want to say that the speaker that spoke yesterday, the white female, during her call, I do think that she's a part of the CIA. I mean, I can just say that, but I do think that at least she had a team working with her, and that she knew that the call could be tampered with, I think. I don't know. But I know that my line was cut out and that I asked a question. I asked, can black people be white supremacists? But that entire sentence was cut out. And it was right after I asked her, actually, I wrote it down. So let's see. I wrote Mr. Gunn, so I'll try to speak quick. I said, my audio was deleted, muted live while I was asking the guest a question. After I asked her what her definition of white supremacy, is, she answered. And then I asked, can black people be white supremacists? My audio was cut out live, which is why I was silent. Which is why there was silence. I was not actually silent. I was speaking during that time period. But Gus asked me a question, asked if I heard her question or if she answered my question. I'm going to stop reading because I'm trying to think too. Because then Gus, you asked me, did you hear her question? And then I started thinking. I was like, well, maybe you didn't hear what I said. Maybe you didn't hear me ask my next question. And I mean, it could be simple, but it's really irritating because now the whole conversation's going on and I'm thinking they must have deleted an entire sentence of me talking, you know? And so how can I then continue to communicate when I don't know which words are going to be deleted or muted? Which sentences are going to be deleted? I don't know what I'm saying. I don't know if you're actually hearing which words you're hearing of mine. So a lot of times I have to change my speed. I have to start speaking fast so that if there's words deleted, you could hear that. Oh, well, from the rhythm that he's speaking, there's been a pause right there. Maybe there's been words deleted. But it's just really irritating because white people interfere with so much of my life. And like even I recently went to my the city I was born in, where my mother and my father owned their house and my grandmother owned her house. And they were right beside each other. It was a decent piece of property. And the school took our land. We didn't sell our rights to that land. They took it. And it's like, it's just the interference that just, they can just take stuff from me. They can take my words. They can take my land. They can take my houses. I can be kicked out. They can take my cars. They've taken my car before, you know, like I spent cash on a vehicle and then they, while I was out of the city trying to help my aunt recover from a stroke, my car was parked in front of my house. It got towed and I didn't know it. It got towed in front of my house because I don't own the street, even though I own the house. And so when I come back, now it's in the impound and it's just about to be sold, you know, away. And so it's just they can take anything. I don't have freedom of speech. I don't have freedom of land. I don't have my genetics. I don't have freedom to pass my genetics to exactly how I want to pass my genetics. You know, I don't have freedom and it's angering. It's really angering. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan Deasy. Expect massive resistance. They have a whole program of white supremacy racism called just that, massive resistance. So they messed with Rosa Parks' phone line, I believe. Dick Gregory talked about that. Would not be the first or even the 50th time that that type of thing has happened in a system of white supremacy. I have to go back to listen. I do recall when Dr. Elizabeth Cobb suspected racist when she was here and Imhan Deasy dialed in. I do remember there being a pause where we weren't hearing him. I wasn't sure if he'd asked another question or, you know, sometimes people hit mute and that sort of thing. I do remember there being a pause where we weren't hearing. So, yeah, I'll have to go back and review to see what it sounds like. See if there was anything where we missed out on you when you called in to get your questions in. But it is frustrating. I totally grasp that system of white supremacy racism. I mean, hey, they can take your life at any time. We had a number of reports about that specifically, taking your life and then anything that falls under that, vehicle, property, life's work, writings, all the rest of it, yoga mat. So, yeah, that's, you know, why we work diligently to try to solve this problem as soon as possible and to try to figure out things to detoxify, because it is very frustrating. It can lead to us being self-destructive, and we don't find an outlet for that frustration. More yoga. Rosa Parks, yoga. Other folks dialed in. If you have a hand up, if you have comments, questions, counter-racist suggestions, line should be open. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I will say briefly, I don't do entertainment, right, on the compensatory call-in, so it's not like we're going to have a discussion on the Watchmen or anything like that. But I think I have said for some time that I think there will be, with the other film, the newer one, it's the black couple. They're out in some chase, Queen and Sugar, I think it is, or whatever. But I just feel like it's racial theater, all of that. They'll just have a proliferation. Josh Wicket said that this sort of thing was going to happen, that it would just be a more flagrant appeal to racism, white supremacy, to market everything. And then they even have, you know, lots and lots of television shows and movies and all the rest of it that is about racism, white supremacy. They'll probably have, you know, Trayvon Martin's murderer will get a reality TV show or, you know, all the rest of it. But that's why I'm not, you know, I don't have anything to say about these films. I haven't seen them and have no interest in seeing them. But I do think it is another aspect of racial theater. I'm super suspicious of anything that white people promote in great numbers, are excited about. They're going to see it too. All of those films I just mentioned, they are playing out here in Seattle. It's not like I couldn't go see them. They don't have enough black people for those to be big hits out here. So, well, I guess The Watchmen isn't going to theaters, but I am sure the streaming services out here work well, and whites are viewing The Watchmen and all the rest of it as well. Racial theater. Talked about that before. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Henry in Chicago. Thank you again for the narration, sir.
No problem, Gus. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Yes, in regards to child abduction, especially with non-white black children, to all the attempted parents, please be wary of your children's whereabouts. We've had a couple of attempted abductions here in the Chicagoland area as well. So, you know, just be wary, and in particular, especially, you know, your child, since they are more susceptible of not being located or found by the authorities. Basically, they won't even look for your child if they're abducted. So please be mindful and wary about
about that. I'm gonna pose the question out there. Hopefully, the audience can help me out here. My daughter likes to read, and you know, outside of the racist books that they're forcing her to read. Now, my daughter's in sixth grade, so they're helping her read, but she also likes to read on her own. Now, she started reading The Hate U Give, and I mean, I don't hate it as much as Gus does, but but I mean, I don't think it's a novel that, you know, that that children should be reading. But at the same time, my daughter likes to read, and I won't discourage her from not reading the book, because I just want her to just read, you know, something. And I'll ask her questions about it, you know, just to make sure. I need a book that she can read after she reads this book. Hopefully some sort of counter-racist productive book for a sixth grader. So if anybody has any suggestions, I will be listening. That's all I have right now. I'll mute my line.
Now that is a good question. A constructive book. I know they have a children's book that's about Nat Turner, written by a black author. I have a book on my list. It's filled with stories. It's like 20 short stories. It's written by black authors. I think that might be a good one. Something that a sixth grader. So that's like 11, 12-ish, somewhere in there. I'll have to think about that. Although I don't have children, again, but I do try to be aware of books, counter-racist literature that younger folks can digest, something that they, not like a Yorugu type of thing, something that's closer to their love. You know, I was thinking, Azur Savage's You Failed Us. She started writing it at 16. I think that's one you don't, you probably would not need like a thesaurus to get through. A teenager wrote it, so that might be one. It's about racism in schools. I have to think of some more.
I was thinking about that one.
Yeah,
I was thinking about that one, and I do commend the young person who came on your show, Zur Savage. She was very 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 mature for her age in regards to knowing about the system of white supremacy. And I was actually surprised she didn't read Dr. Frances Cress Welsin's work, because I could have swore she did, but the way she talked. But yeah,
maybe she will. Maybe she will be even more informed. But yeah, that's a good one. I think I'll nab other folks. Maybe we have other parents, and they can recommend some constructive books that are good for younger people. Is there one where I can think of really quick? Assata Shakur's biography is a lot of it's about her childhood. She's like talking about being a teen and what she was doing going to school. Like it's, you know, her talking about, now she does go back to the case and everything that's going on. But I mean, a lot of it's about her childhood. It's not, you know, the most difficult, The Bluest Eye. That would be, is that, they read that in school? I had to think about that. That'll be my last one. They do read that in school. I think like 13, 12, 13, 14. It might be, you know, a year or two up. Oof.
High school. That's, I read it in high school.
Yeah, that might be a few years, maybe a few years away. Maybe a few years. And that's kind of graphic. Yeah, I forgot about the game. Yeah, never mind. Other folks who dialed in, if we have folks who have literature for young people, it's got to be something really, really good to cleanse the palate after the abomination, The Hate U Give. And I think that's also can be a fantastic strategy if you see your child read. I read The Hate U Give. Worst book ever. So, I mean, hey, I read books that I don't like, too. But I would ask a lot of questions about the book. I wouldn't have to necessarily be an inquisition, but I mean, if this is a book that she's going to take, I assume she's not going to sit and read it in a day. I would ask questions like, oh, man, I read this one, or I don't know if they saw the movie, but yeah, I'm familiar with it. What do you think about the, you know, they talk, do you know who Dr. Huey P. Newton is? Oh, okay. Might be interested. Maybe learn a little bit about him, the way that he's talked about us, a lot of different ways that you can, you know, just ask questions. Whew. Wow, what an abomination. The what is it, the new American classic, The Hate U Give. Woo! Reading is more important than watching television. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we missed you totally, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Radiant Emmy, good to hear from you.
Greetings, beautiful people. The first book that I would recommend is called A Girl Named Disaster. I read it as a young girl, and I loved it. It is written by Nancy Farmer. The title, again, is A Girl Named Disaster. The next one I would recommend is a sci-fi book called Who Fears Death? It's by Nnedi Okorafor, so Nnedi Okorafor. The title again is Who Fears Death. The next author I'll just recommend, her name is Edwidge Danticat. She's a Haitian author, and she's a prolific writer. I was searching through just like a quick list of her books because I forgot the title of the one that I read, but I really did like her. So I would just say to maybe Google her and then kind of peruse some of the books and maybe read a blurb to see if your daughter might be interested. And her name is Edwidge Danticat, E-D-W-I-D-G-E, Danticat, D-A-N-T-I-C-A-T. Another book, I think, I'm a firm believer in setting the bar a little bit higher so that it's a little bit of a challenge with the reading. Sometimes I feel like young people, and I used to volunteer giving away books. I feel like just to give a little context why I say this, like, what does any know about giving young people books? But if it's like something that they're already at that reading level, they might easily get disinterested because there's fun in the challenge of maybe not knowing certain words or some certain concepts might be a little challenging. But I'm a firm believer in giving them a little bit more. So if she already likes to read, I would encourage her to be reading even more difficult books. Not too challenging to where she loses interest, but challenging enough that she grows from it. So this one I think is a high school book, but I think it's a good book nonetheless. It's called Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. Written by a person classified as white, but I don't want to be like a spoiler alert, but it's good. To me, it was good. It's a dystopian novel. Read the back of it. Maybe she might like it. And like the twist at the end is kind of crazy. And I think it does speak to the system of racism and white supremacy. When I read the book, I didn't have that context. I should probably reread it now that I'm talking about it. But I didn't have that. But I do remember thinking about white people when I read it. So. And I would say 1984, but I think 1984 is just a bit much for a sixth grader. But, I mean, ninth grade, she's totally probably ready for it. And then you would have to select, but I really enjoyed Octavia Butler's plethora of work. I love sci-fi novels, like huge sci-fi fan. And so maybe not anything like Xenogenesis, that might be harder, but she has like Terribles. Let me see. Sorry. I was trying to look up everything for, and there are other ones that she might like, but they're not constructive, like Diary of a Wimpy Kid and Percy Jackson novels and all that kind of stuff. But if she's into that, like, sci-fi kind of thing, then she would probably like Octavia Butler. And Kindred was okay. Everyone goes towards Kindred, but it wasn't my favorite of her work. Parable of the Sower, Parable of the Talents. Any of those parable ones, I think, she might like. And also, the final book that I'll say about Octavia Butler, Wild Seed. It's in the middle of the Paterna series, but it's a good start. And just see kind of how she feels it. Like, maybe don't purchase, I mean, I would purchase it as Octavia Butler, but that I'm biased. But you could probably find it in the library and then maybe read, I would say for these texts, read a couple pages with her to see if she can get the cadence and the tone of the work. Because if she can get, like, the imagery in her head, then she'll fly. And I would just totally geek if somebody was geeking like I am off of, like, Black sci-fi, because it's a thing, Afrofuturism. I think that's all I have, but I will continue to think about it, like, the books that I think she might like or that might be good, and then maybe I'll shoot Gus an email and in case I'm not here next time and he can share it with y'all. So I have a couple seconds to just make a quick comment about Rosa Parks before I get off?
I reckon.
Thank you. Much obliged. I know I've been MIA, but in the process, I have been able to deepen my yoga practice. I'm a little halfway through my training, and tomorrow I'll give my first, like, co-teach, hopefully, people who are classified as white are practicing racism against me in the yoga studio. I'm very clear about this, so hopefully my class can come to fruition. If so, I'll check back in and let you all know how it goes. But what I've been, as my practice has deepened and kind of moved a little bit away from necessarily just my mat and moved maybe a little into the other parts of yoga, not just the asanas or the seated position or the postures and seats and all that kind of stuff. The fact that, I don't know which woman said it, but they said that she always had, like, she seemed at peace and she was serene. I'm talking about Rosa Parks. And she always had a, like, gentle smile on her face. And she had a yoga mat. And so I looked to see, like, how do I get to see this exhibit? Because I'm in the D.C. area. How do I get to see it? Because I'd be interested if she wrote about yoga, like, if she was actually practicing yoga. That would be something that would completely catch me off guard about Rosa Parks, because the more I practice, the deeper my practice gets, I think that yoga offers a viable solution to perhaps aiding in healing, not just our physical bodies, but offering non-white people a way out and through dealing with everything that we've been dealing with in the past and now. And so if Rosa Parks was actually practicing, like, I'd love to read if she wrote about meditating, if she read yoga stuff, you know, yoga literature, if she read yoga sutras, if she was how deep is Rosa Parks' yoga practice is something that I am going to try to find out and check back in with y'all. If I can get into the Library of Congress, maybe I can read some journal entries and whatnot, because that's fascinating. Like, I had no idea Rosa Parks had a yoga mat. Maybe she was just stretching on a mat, but what if she was really doing yoga, like the way we think yoga? And maybe, you know, that was a huge part of her life. And if she was super private, maybe she never talked about it. And that would just completely geek me out. But anyway, I just wanted to share that. I hope you all are well. I appreciate y'all for listening to me.
How deep was her yoga practice? Come on. Good luck with your co-teaching. I'm so proud. That is amazing. Just different non-white people who are doing yoga and or doing instructing, taking teacher training to be instructors. Like, I know quite a few non-white people who are doing that. Spectacular. Then you don't have to be reliant on whites. You can teach yourself and you can teach other black people. You don't have to send them the whites. You can teach them yourself. Spectacular. Love it. Love it. And I absolutely agree in terms of the healing properties of a yoga practice. Maybe that was a part of how Rosa Parks sustained herself to continue her counter-racist effort for the duration of her existence. I would be very all right with not knowing that, maintain her so-called privacy, but that is something. If I make it to D.C., I definitely would check out the exhibit to get some info. If you, Emmy or anybody else, if you devote any time to seeing if they have any details to share about Rosa Parks' yoga practice, please share. Folks, we have missed totally. If you have questions, suggestions, *61, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. Another mentoring session, DCS program, was today. The feature, a part that I participated in was the movie Nothing But a Man, starring Ivan Dixon and the great Abby Lincoln. The young fellas actually got it. I think the least that I had to put it on pause and comment on, the more that they were able to listen and view for themselves and have some good understanding of what they were watching. I said it like that because we have young people from as young as 7 years old to 16 years old watching this movie. And basically, I wanted to give reference to them that a lot of the same things that we discuss within the program, you can see some of it demonstrated in the movie Nothing But a Man. I would recommend to anybody who is going to watch a quote-unquote movie, that certainly should be one to view. I think Ivan Dixon, I think who was the director, did a very good job with the movie. It also had, from my understanding, a recommendation from Malcolm X, who said that was the best movie he ever saw, whatever that's worth to you. Other than that, within, I say about 24 hours ago, just about everybody probably knows of this large shootout that took place somewhere around within 5 to 10 miles of me, an area that I frequent a lot for groceries, because Miami Gardens is a literal food desert. So I'm fortunate enough to have transportation to go in areas where white people get food. That's where I get food from. And this, based on a robbery from a jewelry store, it ended in around 5 p.m., large traffic area where the law enforcement just went crazy with gunfire. Somewhere over the vicinity of about 1,000 rounds were fired in this area, full of traffic. The deceased, the two perpetrators reportedly were black males. The UPS driver, I would leave it up to the viewer, if you would care to see it on YouTube, on whether or not that person was a non-white person or not. I'm not sure. The stepfather spoke for that person and described what the police did, well, not police, but what law enforcement did was murder. Spoke in very, not pussyfooting around, if you, as Gus, I've heard Gus say, which is a metaphor, but anyway, he spoke more in terms of the police as being murderers and that sort of thing. And I would just leave it up to the viewer on whether or not that person was a white person or a non-white person. I'm not sure. And that's basically my report for the week. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. We did cover Nothing But a Man in one of our film sessions with Dr. Martin Kevorkian. We had sound clips and all racist jokes. Powerfully depressing film, but very accurate about white supremacy racism. Attempted parents. Talk about attempted parents. Oof, man. But it is very accurate, and I'm not surprised it had an impact on the children. Exactly what you observed, what a retired firefighter shared. He said it seemed like the children, they were into it. You know, they didn't seem like it was a bore, what have you, that they understood, they got it, and him kind of not stopping it too much and just kind of letting it play and letting them watch it, that they seemed like they were even more into it. Mr. Fuller said he's seen the same thing. He said if you try and stop and talk and explain and do all this, he said they're kind of zone out, like, you know. Maybe give them one or two things to watch from the very beginning and then be quiet. He said he's seen where that will work, that they'll kind of start to. Dr. Welsing, it is a metaphor, but I'm doing it deliberately. Brain computer, that's what she would say, that trust that their brain computer does work. That if that's your child, these are young people you care about, trust that that brain computer works. Boop, they will pay attention and get it. Let's see. Oh, yes. It came up before. Pussyfoot as a verb is in the dictionary the exact way that I use it on the program, defined as act in a cautious or non-committal way. That is exactly how I use it on the broadcast. Other folks, dialed in if you have suggestions. Oh, and the books. The book I was thinking of, I forgot the title. The People Could Fly, American Black Folk Tales. It's like a collection of 20 different short stories. The People Could Fly. It's got illustrations and all. Outstanding. I think that might be one too. Other folks, if we missed you totally, if you have comments, observations, suggestions, *61, feel free. If we missed you totally, proceed.
May I be here?
Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and on the line. Man, I hate I missed Dr. Cobbs, like, I just hate I missed her. I remember you advertised it on a different, on another program, probably the one right before it, and probably a lot of them, and then I just missed it. It's just terrible. But anyway, so her comparison of Ms. Tubman to Queen Latifah, Spider-Man, and whoever else.
Mother Teresa.
Thank you. Yes. And I heard that she said, when I say I heard it, I listened to the broadcast, she said that, you know, she that one of the reasons she compared her to Spider-Man is because he's a superhero. But I thought that she was furthering this agenda to masculinize Harriet Tubman. There is such an assault on her image that I mean, I don't know much about her, but she must have been very, very constructive, because the assault on her image to me is just unbelievable. And she wanna sit here and talk about how Spider-Man was a superhero. Well, why couldn't she be Wonder Woman? Why are you gonna compare her to a man? And you know, I thought everybody's comments were great, and questions and things like that, and I really enjoyed what the things that Bea in Toronto had to say, and when she said, "Yeah, you're a professor. There goes affirmative action." I just started laughing when she said that. I just thought that was amazing. And as far as about white females not voting in their interest, the thing is, Hillary Clinton, she's a race soldier, but she talked about, you know, ending racism, and she was like really pretending, and she was talking to black people about ending racism to try to put on this facade as though, you know, she was about that. And maybe some white people believed her, but we know what, you know, Donald Trump was talking about, that President Obama wasn't a citizen and this, that, and the other. That was the interest that they voted in. They didn't want to, even if it came to the first woman president, someone who was just like them, who was a woman, they was not going to vote for that and see the end of white supremacy. They didn't want to vote for someone who was talking about ending white supremacy. On the other hand, you have you know, Donald Trump, who was talking the exact opposite, where he's just demonizing black men and just doing all these, saying all these racist things, like he's just, you know, just a racist spokesperson. He's more explicit about it and not as implicit as Hillary was. And so they definitely voted in their interest. And as far as the feisty comment, that, well, white people call, and white people do that. They call black people feisty. They try to use that for black people. And they actually did that to this one little girl, but I'll talk about that later if there's time. Probably won't be. But anyway, that's code for combative, violent, aggressive, things of that nature. That's what they were saying with Rosa Parks, especially because she was working against racism. She was not feisty. She was courageous is what she was. And the last thing I want to say is that I think the term nightmare is a racist term, and I hope everyone has as best a weekend as they can have, and I'll meet my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, God.
Much obliged, Ivy. I do remember being in Toronto saying, there's your representation of affirmative action right there. Bravo. Bravo. She didn't refute either. She didn't have a word to say about that. Let's see. Oh, I did look up the word feisty when I heard it in the report. I commented about that previously. The dictionary definition for feisty that I have: of a person, typically one who is relatively small or weak. Lively, determined, and courageous, a feisty heroine who's more than a pretty face. That's the example they give. Then the next definition is touchy and aggressive. The example sentence: he got a bit feisty and tried to hit me. Now, wait a minute. Like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Touchy and aggressive, because sometimes they call black people, if you say something about racism, that, whoa, you're a bit touchy. You're kind of, don't they have any of you heard that where they call a black person, whoa, you kind of touchy about this race thing? Has anyone heard that? Almost getting to playing the race card. You kind of sensitive about this here. Has anyone heard that? Maybe I'm just making that up.
Heard of it.
Okay.
I've heard it.
Got a few, or at least a couple. I've heard it more than once. If folk, anyone thinks I'm making it up, you know, feel free. You can check your own experiences and do your own research, which I encourage. But touchy, and even the fact that they are together, touchy and aggressive, he got a bit feisty and tried to hit me. So are they saying that Rosa Parks is touchy and aggressive? We talked about this before, how sometimes that'll be a part of the deception. That's why I said, got to be precise with words. That whites, they will say a message. We talked about that when we read Gwen Ifill's book, The Breakthrough. She was talking about President Obama. They were talking about some of the messaging in his campaign. It was deliberately vague so that it could be interpreted in multiple ways. We talked about that is rife in English language, because you'll have words like this that have multiple meanings. Sometimes it'll be contradictory meanings. Nightmare was just talked about. But touchy and aggressive. And then you go back to the first one, of a person, typically one who is relatively small or weak. And then lively, determined, and courageous. Like, all of that that's supposed to be positive is within the context of a weakling who is courageous. And so that, feisty. I do not use that term to describe people. Like I said, I often hear this term used to describe animals. They said relatively small and weak. I hear people talk about pets as being feisty. I don't use this as an adjective to describe people, ever, generally. Other folks that we missed totally, if you have comments, questions, suggestions, if you have recommendations for literature for a sixth grader who likes to read, definitely need to hear that.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. It was some parts of the audio segment that stood out. Well, not stood out, but that was of interest to me. The first was, I think that was the Young Turks segment, where I think they were talking about the missing young black females. And I think that may have been a black female speaking, and she pointed out the differences of value, of course, of when white children go missing. They have the Amber Alerts on the phones, and no matter where you can be, you'll hear this sound alarm go off or whatever, which it shows that in a system of racism, definitely omnipresent and dominates all areas of people activity. And I think she made an explanation about, she said black and brown, but then she said something about Latinos moving more so toward white or something. I didn't really get that part. She didn't really expound on that part very much. And there was another segment where I think the child was told about, if you reach for the cookie, I'm going to lynch you. And there was another part in that segment where the lady said, oh, well, if you feel that you have been discriminated, like, what has got to do with your feelings? This either happened or it didn't. Like, is this true or not? You know, what has got to do with my feelings? And my last one is, they've been using this term called swing schools on the local news, because I know we had an elementary school closed down on the east side of town, primarily black students. And they said a place called Citizens Field, they wanted to, I guess, have some students bused over to that area. And they're talking about putting a fence to separate the two schools or whatever. So it's been a story that's been going on about that. I'm going to do some more reading on it. But someone said they thought the idea was loaded with racism, or was about racism. And I think, well, it's black children that go to both schools, but it seems like it's some kind of racist experiment. So that'll be one thing that I'm going to be reading up on in the next couple of days. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. Let's see. I wrote my notes down. Oh, I'm so glad you brought up the segment. That was in Illinois, Manuka, Illinois, where we heard from the mother, black mother, where she was saying that she feared for her child's safety, and he tried to get this cookie, and the white race soldier, who's not ignorant about racism, said that he would lynch him. Now, just that language alone, he didn't say, you grab that cookie, I'll beat you down. You grab that cookie, I'm going to tell on you. You grab that cookie, I'm going to punch you in the face. You grab that cookie, I'll kick you. Could've said anything, you know, I'll jab you, whatever. He said, you grab the cookie, I'll lynch you. If anyone is ignorant about racism, black people, this is a white child. He already knows. What do you do to black people? He already knows. I'm also thinking now, unless I didn't hear correctly in the segment, they said that they suspended this race soldier child for 10 days, and now he's coming back to school if he's not back already. And the victim, the black child, he's back. Now, what's that going to be like? Like, you come back, I'm sure this little racist, his white racist buddies are there at the school. Like, oh, man, you got our homie suspended for 10 days, you know. Oh, man, we're going to get you, man. We're going to be looking out. We got a long school year. We're not even at the Christmas break yet. We got a long way to go. We got you, man. Like, is that what you got to look forward to for the rest of the year? Like, oh, man, my God. Talk about yoga and all kinds of de-stress. That's what Dr. Welzick, she would say consistently, if you play around with sex, The joke is on the offspring. You don't have, hey, before we get to the bedroom, let's sit down and talk seriously. Since we like each other so much, there should be no problem for us to sit down for the next week. And that's what we'll do. That'll be our romance. We'll sit down and we'll talk about our child's academic plan for the next 15 years so that they never have to experience someone saying, hey, put that cookie down or I'll lynch you. Anyone we missed totally, you should get a hand up now. Please do not wait till the last, like, 3 minutes to decide you have 8 things that you want to share. Folks have additional suggestions, questions, book recommendations. Proceed.
Ivy
here. I heard both of you. We'll get Ivy first.
Thank you, both of you. I just wanted to, like, shout out this program and you, Gus, or let me rephrase that. Want to say thank you to you, Gus, and to just, you know, the callers, and just this whole program is just amazing, because I ended up getting, I think it was in the same week, 2 credits. Because, like, for my internet service, there were so many things, so much incompetence going on, and also some racism going on, where I was abused at the store, and just so many, and even by some race soldier representatives, and then to add insult to injury, they tried to offer me an unreasonable compensation. And I went and asked to speak to more powerful white people about this situation. And when I finally got to that point, I let them know that because I turned down, I declined, there was actually several payments that were credits that were offered to me, and I turned them down. I turned them all down because I thought that they were unreasonable, as I said. And so when I spoke to a more powerful white person, I let her know that I was prepared to disconnect service because if I don't get reasonable compensation, because that would be further incorrect treatment. And I ended up getting double what I was initially offered, because I was offered a certain amount, and then after that, which was a terrible amount, and then after that, I was only offered $5 more. And then when it was all done, I was offered double that. And I wasn't going to accept anything less than close to that. And so just using words like, you know, incorrect treatment, and, you know, just things of that nature, just the way that I, you know, used words that were suggested by you guys, suggested by Mr. Fuller about going to more powerful white people and things of that nature, rather than words like incorrect treatment, rather than, you know, grievance and complaint and things of that nature. And also another thing that happened with the particular company that I'm that I get a service from, one race soldier, he was harassing me, because what the interesting thing is that I referred someone to the same program, and they somehow messed things up to where I didn't get my referral credit. And then when it got to the point of giving it to me, he wanted to harass me and say, you know, make sure that, you know, the person uses your referral link and things of that nature, while stating that he believed me that the person did use the referral link and things of that nature. The problem with that is that he just kept on emphasizing that I make sure that the person uses the referral link, or that I do things correctly so that they don't miss giving me my credit, and to continue to emphasize this until I conceded, okay. And so I got off the phone, but then what I ended up doing is I called back and I asked to speak to a manager.
have to speak to a more powerful white person, and I'm almost done, and let them know that, you know, I use words like incorrect treatment, and I use words like harassment, that this was harassment, what he kept doing, and I even suggested that she go back and listen to the call and see the harassment, or listen to it, which she was going to do anyway. And what ended up happening in that situation is that not only did I get my referral credit, but I also got 3 months free of this particular service that I'm signed up for. So, again, thank you to you, Gus. Thank you to Mr. Fuller and to all the callers and, you know, just the way that you all use words. Because if I had not known about this program, I would have just let those things go. And I wouldn't have, and Dr. Wilson as well, who always emphasized black self-respect, because that's also maybe even the main thing about what this is about, that, you know, I can, even if I'm going to be mistreated, I can respond. And that was it. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Black self-respect. Love it. Love it. Sometimes that, you know, like I said, sometimes black self-respect, it's just recognizing this is incorrect treatment, and I do not have to accept incorrect treatment. That's Rosa Parks right there. This is incorrect treatment, white supremacy, racism specifically, but I do not have to accept racism, white supremacy at this moment. That is Rosa Parks. She had been doing that way before we got to the bus incident, but that is Rosa Parks. Black self-respect. Black self-respect. The male caller who yielded, much obliged. Did you have commentary?
Yes, I did, Gus. Thomas again. Man, using logic, this was like maybe a month ago, and Donald Trump was giving a convention in Chicago for chiefs of police. All the chiefs of police all around the country went to this convention, except for the chief of police of Chicago. He didn't go and protest, and he stood with the mayor of Chicago, and they did their Trump bashing. And I said, that day, he will be retaliated against for this, and now you see what happened to him. So it's almost like you can start predicting some of the things that's going to happen to black people who are not, you know, doing what white people want them to do in the positions that white people put them in. I thought that was very interesting. So when I saw this week that he's been fired, and the whole scandal surrounding his firing, it was like, man, I knew this was going to happen. People were texting me, oh, you said that he was going to be going. And I knew it. That, like Ivy said, testament to this show. Also, you know, man, I really hate the fact that George Zimmerman is still alive. With all the violence, black people, if you all had, were operating off of a code, I assume someone's code would have been to take him out. And now he's causing more mischief to this family. You know, we have to start operating off code. And I'm mute my line. Thank you, Josh.
Can I be heard?
I think with codification, at least as I understand how Mr. Fuller's written, that is very personal, especially counter-violence. That is very personal counter-violence. Male caller who just spoke up. Oh, that was Imhan DC. Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Yes, sir. I wanted to say a few things. So as far as the global warming and the cows being a big contributor to global warming, they're talking about, so the cows, when they pass gas, you'll hear them talk about cow farting, cows farts heating up the planet. I think that's kind of funny. But they also talk about humans the same way. Just like cows fart and heat up the planet, humans do the same thing. And so they're saying that there's so many humans that the planet is heating up by the number of humans. The more humans there are, the more the planet heats up. Therefore, white people's solution, according to what they're saying very publicly, is to kill so many black people in order to lower the temperature of the planet. But anyway, I wanted to say about the cows. So I drive around a lot, and, you know, I travel a lot. My family, we travel a lot. There's not a whole lot of cows that are, like, I used to see more cows, but now there's so few cows. Like, there's not, we are not eating cows, like, at McDonald's and all those other places. I just don't think there's enough cows to be supplying these places. And I do think that that they may be using human meat. I don't know. I also wanted to say that, I mean, I don't know that. I said that. But human trafficking, what are they doing with all that meat? And then I wanted to say, I am an American. I am an African. Because I'm an American, this is my land. And then everybody who is not an
Are you with us, Imhan DC? No, your volume.
Sounds like you got cut off.
No, his volume dropped out a little bit before, but then it came back pretty resolutely. We have about 10 minutes left in the program. If you're hearing me, Imhan DC, we're not hearing you. Not hearing you. If you can hear me, Imhan DC, we're not hearing you. We have about 10 minutes left in the program. If you can hear me, if you want to hang up and call back in, I'll be like looking directly on the switchboard so I can bring you right back on. You can give us the last bit of what you were saying, but we are not able to hear you, Imhan DC. Okay, I see you. Hang up.
I have something.
Yes, sir. Call in Florida.
Retired firefighter. Yes, sir.
In Florida.
Oh, it sounds like you're back.
Oh, you're good. You're good.
You talking about me, Gus, or?
Oh, you're good. Yes, sir. Proceed.
Yes. On the report that I'm sure most, if not all, heard about with hair, quote unquote, hair products, and how this is the latest report. There's been some well before the one I heard yesterday. Hair products that actually contributes towards, I believe, breast cancer in black females, and what anyone may have to say about that particular report, especially the ladies.
Much obliged. Imhan DC is back with us. Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. Imhan DC, you are back with us. So we lost you when you said, I am an American, and we lost you. So if you want to start from, I am an American, and give it to us, Crystal.
Oh. Well, thank you. Okay, so at least I got there. So I was saying, I am an American, and I am an African. Because I am an American, this land is my land. This land belongs to the Americans. Everybody who is not an American does not belong on this land. Unless the Americans... What happened? What's this? Am I...
We hear you loud and clear.
Huh. Okay. So... yes, so no one's allowed on this land unless the Americans allow them on this land. The same way in Africa. I am an African, and because I am an African, nobody is allowed on that land unless the Africans are allowed on that, say that they are allowed on that land. What I was saying is white people are not allowed on our land. My phone's doing funny things. Thank you.
Happens regularly. Much obliged, Imhan DC. Think we heard you clearly that time. Any other folks we have about?
Can anybody hear?
Henry in Chicago. Yes, sir.
All right. Want to say thanks to Emmy and everybody else who
anybody else who suggested books for my daughter to read. Gus, I was going to ask, I was going to pose this question to you, but when I was reading and listening to the thing about the young race soldier who told the non-white black boy that he was going to lynch him, the question I was going to ask is, what do you mean that white people are experts in racism? Then after I read that incident, I thought about it for a minute, because about 4 years ago, Illinois just passed a Senate Bill 100. And what it is that it eliminated the no tolerance policy in the public schools in Illinois. So that means that schools that are public and charter have to have some sort of intervention. They can't expel or even suspend a student without reasonable cause of an imminent threat. Obviously, this is an imminent threat, but they don't see it, to other students. So they're going to do, I guess, some intervention instead of, you know, charging this young race soldier with, you know, with a hate crime or an act of terrorism, if you ask me. But I think white people know that with this bill, because a couple of weeks ago, you know, we had the incident in Naperville where the race soldier put up a you know, put up an ad on Craigslist talking about he was selling his friend who was a black boy as a slave, and he hasn't been suspended neither. So I think that answered my question about white people being experts at racism. I'll mute my line.
White people can show you better than I can tell you, Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. Great quote. Should be in the book. And that, I do think that that's important, that incident where the young white race soldier told the black child, touch that cookie, and over something trivial, right? It wasn't, you touch that white girl, and touch that cookie, and I'll lynch you. Baked products, really? I baked cornbread today. That's not, anyway. This was in Illinois. This was not in Mississippi or Georgia or Alabama, Bloody Loudons. This was in Illinois, right in, what they say, the metaphor of President Obama backyard. Not quite Chicago, but I mean, yeah, this was up north, as they say. Great information about the no tolerance policy, because the victim's mother, she said she wanted that child expelled. And she just said, hey, can't do that. Oh, wait, this is not. He just said something awful. We've sat him out for a few days. He's back now. We'll move forward. This will be a teachable moment. Isn't that what they say? Another metaphor. Let's see. You have about 45 seconds if anyone else has a comment.
May I be heard?
Yes, the one and only caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Just really quick, that segment, that was another one I wanted to share on the YouTube videos. That I think that was a white woman or two white women speaking, and she was asked about the word harm and her having a definition for what's considered harmful. And she said, well, you know, if someone is discriminated against because they are not white or something and they couldn't get a job, then, you know, that's harmful. But if we have a video that's labeled white people are superior or something like that, then that's not harmful. So that woman sounded like a expert in racism, and that's all I had to share.
Now, just the fact that those are the examples, we're talking about what is harmful, and these are the examples that are given for what is considered harm. That's interesting. Also, consistently, I say, when you ask for a definition, what do you mean when you say harm? What do you consider harm? You don't want or the example is fine, but you want the definition first. When I read you the definition for feisty, they give the definition first, and then they give you an example of how it's used in a sentence. That's what I want. This is our code for determining what is harmful. And then, according to that code, boop, these are examples. Boom. And this is why this video saying that, you know, if you are a nigger, you cannot be employed. If you're a gadfly, you cannot be employed. But white people are superior according to the code. That's what you want. She didn't give that. And that whites tend to be very skillful. This white woman, I think, made the recommendation that they buy YouTube. She's not expert. If anyone is ignorant about racism, white supremacy, it is black people. And they got a white woman who is in charge of doing the moderation. I thought it was patriarch. Me too. Yes, yes. I did want to make sure that I got in the Young Turks. I thought that that was super act of racism, white supremacy. And I believe they got the victim of white supremacy, the black female reporter, to say that who's talking about this, missing black children, but the Young Turks. That is totally false. I've seen the Washington Post do major reports on missing black children in Washington, D.C. and beyond. Gus T. Renegade has written for Atlanta Black Star about missing black children. We have done programs on the cows about missing black children. Many other black authors, black journalists, black people who have written entire books, Cisco Street Love, the late, we had him as a guest on the program. He wrote about missing black children. It is not just the Young Turks. That is disgusting. And in my view, a deliberate act of racism, again, because you do have editors for the Young Turks in these productions. It could have been scripted to have her say this, that who's talking about this other than the Young Turks, a sly promo, even if that's hyperbole, it's false. And it denies you have a lot of black journalists who for a long time, even Rosa Parks talked about missing black children who were being lynched at that time. She was a journalist. She was someone who was doing that work. She was not a journalist, take that back, but she was doing the work of talking about black children who were ending up being mistreated. The Scottsboro Boys, she did a lot of work on that. So, I mean, this is a long-running problem that many people way before the Young Turks and since the Young Turks have been talking about. And within that report about the so-called Latinos, they said black and brown. I've already discouraged using that term. But I think what they said was, they eventually, the victim, again, she said that Latinos on the census or other public records, they'll be considered white when it's beneficial to whites, and then non-white when it is not beneficial to them. I think they did add that little tidbit. Were you going to add something in? Okay, just heard that.
Oh, no, I was just acknowledging that. That is, thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember they did add that little portion in. Remembering who does the classifying is important, but I think we have also discouraged using the term Latino on the program. The classification, are you white? Non-white. Latino is not a racial classification designed to cause confusion. Words. So glad we had such a focus on words for the evening. If you're in the D.C. area and you're able to check out the Rosa Parks exhibit, please do. If you do any research on Rosa Parks Yogi, please share. I would be curious about that. Good luck to Emmy with co-teaching tomorrow. I'm sure you'll do a fantastic job. Remember to get them to breathe. Get them to breathe. They should. Neighbors should hear them breathing. And breathe with your students. That's the big one. Breathe with your students. You get confused. Do the posture. You'll do great. We'll be back. Minimum for the book club. Oh, man. Book. I guess if you would like to vote. We had a lot of people who said we should do 48 Laws of Power. And that has been like on the book list for a long time. We voted and it was like number two. I think Irie and some other people just mentioned it again. We were going to read that last time around. And I think that was, we got kind of switched to Paul Robeson at the last moment. I'm thinking we should just go ahead and push through that now because it keeps coming up and we can just be done with it and move on. But I have to think if someone has a recommendation for Jonestown, because we are going to address that. But if there's a audiobook that's already available, I am not narrating and I'm not interested in having to beg anyone else to do the narrating. The narration would have to already exist. And a constructive read, if folks have a recommendation there, feel free. If not, don't worry about it, because we will be addressing Jonestown on the program shortly. But if you have a recommendation, share. If not, You should just do 48 Laws of Power and be done with that. Robert Greene. And that's easily book. I think you can get that at the library. Super easy. Shouldn't be difficult to find. And I don't think that's... I think we would probably learn a few constructive tidbits. With that, much obliged to everyone for participating. I hope the broadcast has been worthy of your Saturday evening. Check Black Talk Radio Network, Facebook, other outlets for updates for all of the upcoming broadcast times, schedules, guests, etc. If you have problems, guest recommendations, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We are under dangerous conditions, intentionally dangerous conditions. We want our brain computer functioning optimally so that we can be as safe as possible. In addition to being sober, let's make sure we're buckled up, driver or passenger, every time we are in a vehicle. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. In addition to being sober and buckled, if you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Imhan DC, repeating what he said. Again, just trying to do the little things we can to try to stay as safe as possible. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Kyle signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.